In the Environment, Economic Development, and Agriculture Division for Monday, April 22nd, 2013 will come to order. We have a full house today, and just so everybody who hasn't been here before knows that we have some decorum things that we do in our committees, and one of them is no cheering and no applauding and making comments about comments that are being made at the table. But the only thing you really can do is when the chair makes a joke, you can laugh if you want. But other than that, we want the people here to be able to express their opinions and say what they think. What we're going to do here is that we're going to have a couple of bills up before we get to the Senate File 901, and Senator Dietzick is going to do the LCCMR bill. If somebody feels they need to testify on something, let one of the pages know, and those are these two guys over here, and we can get your names on the list here. So let's get started. We have a quorum, so Senator Dietzick, let's get started with Senate File 987.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Before you is Senate File 987, the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources, also known as LCCMR, the 2013 recommended proposals. This past summer, LCCMR received 169 proposals from its request for proposal process, totaling approximately $155 million. We heard about 69 proposals this summer. We are suggesting 46 proposals be recommended to the 2013 Minnesota legislature to collectively receive $38.2 million in funding from the Environmental and Natural Resources Trust Fund. These recommendations range from full funding for some projects to partial funding for specific proposal elements. The largest funding request is to the U of M for an aquatic invasive species research center headed by Peter Sorensen to develop much-needed expertise and new techniques to control AIS, aquatic invasive species, threats to our environment and economy. Current focus will be on zebra mussels, common and Asian carp, Eurasian water milfoil, but will be flexible to add new programs to address the state's urgent needs. It will develop effective tools to locate species, research ways to delay the spread, and create effective technologies and techniques to for eradication. The center will work with the DNR, USGS, and other interested parties. You have several handouts in your packet, including a sheet of the breakdown of projects by subdivisions, a summary of the proposed appropriations by subdivisions and expected outcomes by subdivisions, and the 2011 biennial overall overview report. We heard many projects relating to invasive species. Invasive species, from Asian carp to zebra mussels to garlic mustard to emerald ash borer, have the potential to seriously damage our environment and our economy. We are recommending funding to several of these projects to help control or stop the spread and the consequences of the spread. 22 of the projects we are recommending are statewide projects or have statewide implications, like the AIS Center, Sudan Mine Lab, or improving the control of emerald ash borer detection. 13 projects are non-metro regional projects, including a project to evaluate a new approach to forest inventory to reduce costs and improve usability in central, northeast, and northwest Minnesota, project to improve water quality in up to 14 lakes in southern Minnesota, project to help restore moose habitat in northeastern Minnesota. We have 11 projects in the greater 11-county metro area and adjacent areas, like the Frogtown Park Farm and Park acquisition that leveraged additional nonprofit funding to provide increased green space and a demonstration farm in a local low-income, culturally diverse area in St. Paul. If you look at the chart, you'll see that about 10% of the funding is going for water resource projects. 35% is going to land habitat restoration and recreation projects, 29% to aquatic and terrestrial invasive species. Environmental education gets about 1.67%. Admin gets about 3%, and natural resource data and information gets about 21%. I think I had a bunch of other handouts up there. You should have a story on the AIS Center, a little handout on emerald ash borer. We have about 3 million ash trees in the city and about a billion on forest land in Minnesota. So that shows you the impact of the spread of AIS, or the spread of emerald ash borer, also known as EAB, that it could have on the economy and just the natural resources in the state. You also have a handout on the Sudan Mine Project in northern Minnesota that kind of shows some of the really interesting things they can do. I mean, they're in an underground mine, an old abandoned mine. They literally see, like, you know, dirt on the ground, and they go, oh, that's a fungus, and that blah, 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 fungus can do blah, 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 blah. And right now they're specifically hoping to be able to protect bats from the white nose.
Senator Dietzig, was that real technical description?
Yeah. That's my scientific blah, 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 blah. But they get so excited talking about little dirt and little fungus that, you know, you're looking at it going, well, how can you tell? We also heard a project and are proposing to fund a project on the quality of the water in Lake Superior, and you have pictures there that show after the storm in June 2012, all the runoff that went into the lake, and so we're just wondering how the impact of that will be on the quality of that lake. And then bees. We are funding a project on bees. The Upper Midwest is one of the top bee and honey producers, and the economic impact in the U.S. For bees and agriculture was about $20 million in the year 2000, and so with the decline of bees, that could have a huge impact on our agricultural in Minnesota. With me today is Susan Thornton. Oh, I actually have an A2 amendment, so I'd like to move the A2 amendment if possible.
Okay, let's pass out the A2 amendment. Senator Dietzig, well, it's been passed out. You might as well start explaining it. Or do you want one of the staff to do it?
I can go over it.
Go ahead. Okay. I'm just checking.
She's here to help me if need be. So right now we have a lot of the grant management is run through the DNR, and so we're having discussions on if they're going to keep doing it or if the Department of Admin is going to do it. There's some pros and cons to both, and I think they believe there's pros and cons to both. So you can see, to keep the discussions going, we are replacing and putting in Department of Admin. We're actually deleting probably Natural Resources and inserting Admin. On lines 116 to 121, we had a lot of talks over the past summer on what is a direct and necessary cost. So what administrative costs should be covered through the projects. And so this language is to help clarify. In the RFP in previous years, rent was not allowed as a cost, because at one point you had somebody that came and pretty much rented the Taj Mahal to do the project, and so we took rent out. But as you're moving forward, and the cost of computers weren't included, because computers used to be so expensive, and the purpose wasn't to supplement somebody else's administrative costs and their whole budget by this. We want to work on a project, not other costs. And so this is just helping to clarify what costs they can are direct and necessary. On line 125 to 220 are all projects that have already received funding. The funding is still there, but because of the cycle that the funds go from, they start in like July 1st, and that's in the middle of an agriculture season and of a summer. So sometimes they don't finish in the time frame of a July to July, and so we give them the rest of the season. And so this is just extending the time frame on those projects out a year. So there's no money, additional money involved in any of those. On line 3.14, 3.15, and 3.16, this past year there was some questions when they were appointing people, the length of the terms, and so this just clarifies that. That appointed citizen members shall serve 4 years, beginning in January the first year and continuing through the end of December of the final year. And then on page 4...
So they have a longer term than the legislators, though?
Well, 4 years, so...
Legislators are two.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah.
We can change it.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, this is certainly a significant difference here, and I guess I'd like to know what the rationale was actually talked about, how that came about.
For the terms?
Yes. The length of terms is what I'm talking about.
Is the terms different or no?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, this just...
Say your name.
Thank you. Susan Thornton, Director of the LCCMR.
Thank you, Ms. Thornton.
Thank you. Senator Ingebrigtsen, this... The original length of terms for non-legislative members in the original bill that created the LCCMR was 3 years. Through an inadvertent amendment that through those 3 years were removed, and by default it would be 4 years. We're just clarifying in the language that it is the 4 years. So there's not a change here. In fact, all the serving members currently on the LCCMR, the non-legislative members, have a length of term of 4 years.
So just a follow-up question. So when did this inadvertently happen? I guess I don't know that. Was it some time ago or was it just recently?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it was some time ago. Mr. Knopf and I spent quite a bit of time researching, trying to figure out when it happened.
What's an inadvertent amendment?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
It was an amendment, I believe it was in a Senate committee, at which the term limits for legislative members was taken off, and part of that sentence had the length of term for the non-legislative members, so it was through the amendment process to remove term limits. Mr. Chair, we didn't realize until we went back and researched it when new appointments started being made for 4 years.
Mr. Knopf, how did it go from 3 to 4?
Mr. Chair, as Ms. Thornton explained, the general rule for these types of entities is 4 years. If you look at the general law that they operate under, they're 4-year terms. The original bill did have 3 years, but there were a number of changes made to this part of the bill as it was working through the process. And through those changes, there were the term limit or the terms were not specified for the non-legislative members, and so then it defaulted to the so it never was they never were 3-year terms. The report that came back to the legislature in 2008 specified 3-year terms for non-legislative members, but it never in the bill that created it was altered through the process, and those terms dropped out, so it reverted to the default of 4-year terms. And the 2 years are for the legislatures, of course, because the House has 2-year terms, and there are certain years when the Senate has 2-year terms. So it was thought that every 2 years this would be updated. Now, Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council has a little different phraseology in there, and they basically say that they're at the pleasure of the appointing authority. But for LCCMR, it says that they are 2-year terms to coincide with with basically a biennial session.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Knopf, would you also talk about the Clean Water Council, what the difference there would be? Are they the same?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, those would be 4-year terms. They're under a similar – the default provision generally for these types of entities are 4-year terms if you look at the statutes that they're supposed to operate under.
Mr. Chair, I just for what it's worth, the 4 years certainly seems to make sense and kind of coincides with everything else. I was just a little confused as to how it came from 3 to 4, so that's all. Thanks.
Well, I think 2 makes more sense than 4, Senator Ingebrigtsen. But go ahead, Senator Dietzick.
We can discuss that. It's all open for discussion. And then if you go to page 413 and 414, we've had some discussions on when the approved work plan and budget expenditures can be changed, and so we're just setting up modifications to the approved work plan and budget expenditures shall be made through the amendment process established by the commission. And then on the last page, if we do choose to transfer duties from DNR to admin, which, again, I believe they're both here and they can testify because I think there's angst on all sides, this just transfers the positions. This is not a cut of any employees, because if the admin does it, they may need some employees, so we will just shift those over. So,
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator, for that. Just a point of clarification, maybe Mr. Knopf can help me with this, or legal. The 17.13 of the amendment that's on your first page, line 1.15, and maybe it's addressed at the end of the amendment on transfers and transition. Does that take care of the separation of power question that I have? Does this amendment take care of that, or is there something to be concerned about here in this? In that 17.4 section.
Well, Mr. Chair, there really is not a separation of powers issue. This is just the agency that they contract with to administer the grants, because they can't administer the grants themselves. If they tried to, that would be a distribution of powers issue. But what this does is currently the if you look on the Section 9 in the amendment, it is under current law that the Commissioner of Natural Resources has been doing this. There's nothing in the statute on it, but in the session law, they've been administering the grants for the LCCMR. And what this would do then is to transfer that authority to the Commissioner of Administration. And then wherever you see administration on line 1.4, 1.6, 1.15, that's all to set up the Commissioner of Administration as the authority to issue the grants and to write the contracts and that sort of thing.
Senator Ingritz.
So this is relatively new then, or is this just clarification language? The DNR, you say, has been administering this and are going to continue to do
that? No, Mr. Chair, under this proposal, it would be the Commissioner of Administration, not the DNR, issuing the grants to the non-state entities. To state entities, you appropriate the money directly, but to the non-state entities or NGOs, the common phrase, Department of Administration then would become the granting authority under this. It is different from what you've done in the past. It's been DNR, and this would be new. And I think the author, Senator Dietzick, talked about that when she handed out the amendment.
So, Senator Ingritz.
So, go ahead. I mean, maybe you have some concerns as
no,
well.
No, I was just going to ask DNR. If somebody wanted to comment on the amendment. But is there anybody who wants to comment on the amendment? Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources, and I believe Department of Administration may want to comment as well on the amendment. We are in conversations with the LCCMR about how these grant-making authorities should be dealt with. The only concern I have here would be on the amendment, Section 9, Transfers and Transition, where it says on line 5.5, powers, duties, responsibilities, personnel, and assets. The personnel we have doing these grants, they do not just do LCCMR grants. They do other grants for us as well. They handle the Outdoor Heritage Funds appropriations. They'll be handling some other appropriations that are moving through the legislature. And they also deal with federal grants as well. So while we can certainly transfer powers and duties and responsibilities, transferring of our personnel at this point in time is nothing that we would not support that language at this point. So the authorities and the responsibilities are fine, but
that's the last time
we have a lot of time and energy invested in our staff, and we'd like to keep them. So,
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Meyer. That was just to make sure we didn't want, because we didn't know who was doing what, and we didn't want anybody to feel that all of a sudden they weren't going to have a job because we were switching it over. So that was just protecting the employee if for some reason this does happen, and we're still discussing it. So that's
Senator Ingritson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And well, so that bodes the question, if the DNR employee is no longer going to be doing this and administering it, what is the DNR going to be doing with the time of that employee if it's not going to travel with them? They're the ones busy doing
Mr.
that as
Chair,
well as the equipment.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, we do a lot of pass-through grants and a lot of grant-making provisions. I mean, we do a lot of grant work related to natural resources. The Outdoor Heritage Fund, CPL grants. There's a lot of other work that we do through federal dollars and other state programs that are these grant-making staff will be taken full advantage of. We'll use their time in other proficient ways for the department. So what I'm trying to say is at this point, we do not want to transfer any of our personnel to the Department of Administration to deal with this issue. So,
Members, Senator Dietzick, is this your first committee?
Yes.
So is this an author's amendment?
Yes.
And put the bill in the shape that you want it in?
I guess, yes.
Okay. We normally allow authors to do that, members, and so let's do that, and then we'll discuss it. Because if, in fact, personnel is causing some heartburn here and the intent is different from the author than what you think it is, Mr. Meyer, then maybe as we go through here, maybe we have to figure out how to interpret this and how to fix it. So on the A2 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion adopted. Okay. Go ahead. Is there any further comment? Does the admin want to comment on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ryan Church with the Department of Administration. And last Friday, I think our staff had a chance to talk with the author about the possibility of changing the contract management services from Department of Natural Resources to admin. Really appreciate the outreach on that. And at that time, we raised a couple of concerns and questions, and if you don't mind, I'd just highlight those here as well.
Please let us know.
And just to back up a little bit, the LCCMR has asked its staff to do some fact-finding related to the contract management services that are currently provided by DNR. As a part of that process, we've had a couple of meetings with staff from LCCMR, also the LSARD, SAMS Outdoor Heritage Council, as well as some staff from Department of Admin and Natural Resources. And really the purpose of those meetings have been to clarify what are the concerns with respect to the current arrangement with DNR, and also to identify some options for ensuring that the commission's and the council's grant management needs are well served. Those meetings have been good, but they've probably raised as many questions as they have answered. And so we're hopeful that we'll be able to continue those conversations and sort this out in a real and practical way. But kind of three points I would just raise. First of all, a question of capacity in the Department of Administration. As you may know, we have a very small Office of Grants Management. It's basically a director and another person. Their primary responsibility is to create standards and policies for grants management across state government for the $1.2 billion that are awarded by the state on an annual basis. Their capacity is compounded by the fact that we've had 100% turnover in that office just in the last few months, so the director has been there a little more than 3 months, and the other staff person a little bit less. Their plates are very full. So we have a very basic, practical, not to get into the weeds, but a very practical question of the staffing capacity of that unit. The second issue is one of just neutrality. As I understand it, there is some concern about perceived conflict of interest with DNR playing this role. I don't know a lot about what those concerns are. I've also heard concerns about separation of powers and those kinds of issues. I'm not sure that I fully understand what's been discussed in that vein. But I think it's important to note that within the Department of Administration, we're not without some of those same complexities. So again, thinking about the Office of Grants Management, its function is to establish these policies and procedures statewide and then oversee those policies and procedures. We also have the authority to grant exceptions to those policies and procedures when they would be advantageous. So for example, a state agency, Department of Health, wants to change the way it does its reconciliations. We are authorized to offer an exception to the standard policy so they can experiment with that and they can innovate and find a more streamlined and transparent way to do their work. We don't, however, grant exceptions to ourselves. The Office of Grants Management, if it were also administering these grants, would not be in a position to grant exceptions to itself because that would be a conflict of interest as well. And lastly, it's just a matter of expertise. Certainly, it's hard for me to imagine that Department of Natural Resources or other environmental agencies wouldn't continue to play an important part in helping focus these resources and coordinating these activities so they can have the maximum impact on the ground. That just isn't something we have. We're purely an administrative agency, don't have that kind of expertise. So how we would coordinate and work with those other experts to make sure that these things deliver on their intended purposes is still yet to be known. So I guess just from the admin perspective, the bottom line here is that we would want to make sure that we come up with a sound solution for the commission and, for that matter, the council, because they've been involved in these conversations as well, and really get back to focusing the energy on these natural resources projects and the impact they can have versus the administrative process that's supposed to support them. So we're hoping that the meetings will continue and we can sort through these many issues and hopefully give you a better sense of what's going to be most workable. Because that's what we want to be able to do, even if it meant that we were not able to make these changes this year. So, Mr. Chair or members, I'd be happy to take
any questions of the admin, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess that still bolts the question, are you going to need more staff to administer when the DNR is not willing to give any staff up to administer? Are you going to have more staff time to administer this section of the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, absolutely we would. I believe the bill currently provides some resources for additional staff. Again, without really understanding what our role would be or what it would take, I don't know if that's the right amount, but there is absolutely, again, back to my first point about capacity, there is simply no way the Department of Administration could administer these grants without additional support or resources.
And is there any ability for you and the DNR to cooperate in the use of personnel?
Mr. Chairman, I would hope so. I mean, I don't know how that's all going to work out, but I think however this works, again, I cannot imagine Department of Administration doing this without a direct connection and coordination with the Department of Natural Resources for the expertise that they have, not only in the grants administration, but in land acquisition areas, for example. You know, there's a lot of work that goes on there that we just wouldn't have any expertise in.
Okay. Thank you very much. Oh,
just real quickly, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I don't want to, you know, stop the work that's going on, but you did say that you'd be willing to work with the agency, the DNR agency, as well as the author of the bill as it moves forward. This, I think, has been to policy already, and it's going to be coming yet to finance, I'm assuming.
Yep. So
it just seems like the cart before the horse thing here. You haven't got this all worked out. And I don't think it's a big, big thing, but, you know.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, part of the reason the House bill still has DNR in here, and so just in case, because as we move this forward and they're continuing discussions, just in case for some reason it does shift to admin doing it, we decided we should put them in there just in case for some reason that's what happens. But the discussions are going to continue. The House bill has DNR, so that's kind of the plan, and was just to be prepared in case for some reason they decided they were going to end up taking it. So.
Mr. Chair, nothing more on that. You want some other questions yet?
Yes. Senator Dietzig, did you have some comments? Thank you.
Basically, we kind of went through the big overviews. We can either go through the bill or there's stuff in front of you. I have with me, as before, Susan Thornton, and so we can answer questions,
whatever people want. On the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator, for allowing me to ask these questions. 9.9B. Pollination habitat. Real quickly, that just came to the forefront in my district. I don't know if this is referred to as the bee crossing bill. I don't know or not. But I know there's some issues with this. Could just somebody just real quickly tell me what those are? I think just for information, if nothing else, why the expenditure and why the need there. I don't disagree with it. I just, you know.
On the bee pollinator one?
That's right.
Okay. As I had mentioned, I'll start so she can figure out, but as I had mentioned that in 2000, the economic impact of to ag for the honey and the bees was $20 billion in 2000, and the upper Midwest, including Minnesota, is one of the top bee and honey producers, and so as we've seen a decline in bees, they're trying to figure out how can we fix that, because again, it's such a huge economic impact. Is what the project will do is they're looking at other ways to, like on golf courses and areas of the rough, can we plant some plants that will attract more bees and help the bee colonies? And so it's looking at other areas, and I will let.
That's fine.
Anything else?
Senator,
thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. So the state association, and I think there is one, is certainly in agreement with this to find out and do the research. Is that right? That's the testimony you took? Okay. The second question I would have, and thank you, Mr. Chair, is on conservation grazing of WMAs. I understand that the DNR is going to let grazing go on WMAs as a management tool. I get that. I'm wondering if you had any discussion, and I think it's worth talking about. I don't know what the fiscal implications would be with regards to the area of elk in northwestern Minnesota, whereas I've been kind of working on that not working on it, been informed on the potential of elk expanding up there, and the grazing actually of the WMA would actually hurt that particular part of our habitat, that being of the herd of elk up there. Now, that herd of elk is, depending upon who you talk to at any one given day, the numbers on it, I'm not sure, but when you talk about grazing, a partnership with grazing for cattle, it doesn't hurt the white habitat near as much as it might potentially hurt the elk habitat. So I was wondering if anybody had any discussion in the committee about specifically Kitson County, Roseau County, I believe, or maybe Marshall County. I think Eastern Marshall County. I don't know if there's any talk about that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, no, the elk did not come up. We had many hours of conversations on grazing, goats grazing, cattle grazing, fences, but I don't remember specifically any impact to the elk. And so that's something that that's a DNR project, and so we can go back to them to just double check to make sure that they are aware of the potential impact.
That would be great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, if you would do that, and I'd certainly help you with that. I would be interested in working with that, because it was brought to my attention of somebody in that area who has raised elk and said, you're really kind of damaging the habitat for elk. And, of course, we don't worry about that in central Minnesota or southern Minnesota. So, Section 11.27, Assessment of Natural Copper Bedrocks. This is regards, no doubt, to the non-ferrous mining. And I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, I'm sure you're of interest to this because it's from up your area there, the non-ferrous work that's been going on, the many, many millions of dollars that have been spent on studies. I'm wondering if we're getting a little more redundant here. I wonder how much has been spent on this. I guess I kind of throw that out as a not only an author question here, but a chair question, and I know you certainly would be concerned about that. I guess I just am as well, the amount of time and money that we spent on these studies for the copper nickel mining situation up there, non-ferrous mining. And I see it's got a deadline of 2016, so that means that we're not going to be moving forward anymore. We're not moving forward until that time. Is that correct? Is that a fair estimate? A fair estimation of time?
Ms. Thornton, you have a answer to that?
Sure. Senator Ingebrigtsen, this was the time frame requested, and often on these of a research nature, we add additional time to them because they just need they need more than 2 years to have a sufficient project and produce the outcomes in these complicated issues. And the goal of this project, this is with NRRI in cooperation with the USGS, and the goal of this is to actually assess what's naturally occurring and what the naturally occurring minerals impact has been on the water quality, so that you have a baseline. So once mining takes place, and if then when there's remediation, they'll know where they started from pre-mining and pre-restoration. So the Natural Resources Research Institute came forward with this proposal so that we have the best scientific analysis available prior to beginning any mining that may take place.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, so this has nothing to do with the $1.5 million that we spent on the sulfur research, I think, last year, 2 years ago? I think we're going to...
For the wild rice, you're talking
For the wild rice. So it would have nothing to do with that. This would be over and above that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes, this is a different assessment.
Thank you.
That's a really good question, Ms. Senator Ingebrigtsen, because some of this stuff, you never know why we're doing it, or if somebody just came up with an idea and decided to do something, because it's kind of like some of the permitting we do in the mining. I wonder what we don't know about mining after we've been doing it for 125 years, that it takes us 4 years and $30 million to get air permits and water permits to reopen a mine that was operating not too long ago. So some of this stuff is pretty interesting. Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair, before you go on.
Senator Dietzick.
The partners for that project, so the U.S. Forest Service and Superior National Forest, Duluth Metals, Twin Metals Mining, and Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission are actually partners on that last project.
That didn't give me a lot of comfort, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there any more questions on the bill itself? Okay. Then, Senator Dietzick, do you have anything more we should know?
There's a lot of interesting projects. It was very an honor to be there and sit through discussion. It was like having a crash college course and exciting to see all the different science opportunities and research opportunities and just the creative minds of people looking to do those. So I thank the members for their time and ask for your support.
Ms. Thornton, do you have any Final comments?
Mr. Chair, no, thank you.
Okay. All right. Then Senator Dietzig moves that Senate File 987 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Thank you. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have before you Senate File 1011, and Mr. Chair, members, what Senate File 1011 seeks to accomplish is to provide some funding on a secure and sustained basis for the clean energy resource teams as developed in by state law. Section 216C.385. Mr. Chair, this is a subject that's been before the legislature now for a couple of years. The CERTS teams, I think folks are familiar with them, the partnerships that have been created, and they're divided up into districts around the state, and they partner with utilities, with communities, with businesses, with individuals on conservation and efficiency initiatives, as well as clean energy generation and production, and have been extremely successful. They're very highly regarded, very popular. They were funded, the state piece, if you will, or the public resources that came out of the Renewable Development Fund. We had the Renewable Development Fund reform. From last year, we secured some one-time funding for them, but now we're back to secure a slightly more stable and sustained source of funding. And so what we're proposing to do is in the assessment that is made against the utilities presently of $3.6 million annually for applied research and development grants, that we would take about 500,000 of that. Well, exactly, not about, exactly 500,000 of that per year for this purpose. Per year? Yes. For this purpose. Additionally, Mr. Chair and members, we do request, this is a little piece of, or a little reform piece. This is my idea. It's on lines, on the second page, starting line 2.1, I think, if that's the current engrossment that I'm working off of. Anyways, in the second section, we ask for a report on what exactly is done with this $3.6 million, because we don't have a full accounting. You know, we don't want a full-fledged report that's really complicated, just kind of a listing of what's done with this $3.6 million. Some of it we know goes to the University of Minnesota for some of the energy code research that goes on between the Department of Commerce and others. Then we have these applied research grants that occur. And of course, the CERTs, they do report on their activities, but we'll just have a unified place to do that reporting. We do have an amendment we need to make on an effective date. I think that's the A1 amendment. I'm not sure if it's in your packet.
Do we have an A1? Do we have the amendment? Can you say it early? Senator Dibble?
Sorry?
Can you state it?
Oh, sure.
I have it written here.
Is this right? Is this right? It says that the effective date, paragraph C, is effective for assessments for state fiscal years commencing on or after July 1st, 2013. Do I need to change the amendment?
Why? It's brought up by legal in the House.
All right.
Apologies.
All right. So the amendment needs to be amended so that it reads.
So you have an amendment there?
And yeah.
We don't have one floating around anywhere here?
No. So,
all right. Chair. Well, Mr. Chair, if we want to suspend, I can have this duplicated in my office and sent around because it has some other language, too. Yeah.
Go ahead. Why don't we do that?
Mr. Chair, members, I do have the CERTS ladies here, the 216C.385 ladies, if you want to hear a little bit more from them about what they do and why they're so popular.
Who wants to go first?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lissa Polish. I serve as our CERTS statewide director. I guess I would say to our popularity, it's because we work hard. We do work via 7 regional teams, and on your handout, you can see the map of the state. I will emphasize that because it's people on the ground with steering committee members at that local level who really guide our day-to-day work. They help us get a sense for what are the emerging issues. One of the things that we've heard just this last year is, you know, to look again more at energy efficiency. We've done a lot of great work with utilities around the state, trying to help them move forward, helping them think about opportunities in lighting, helping them achieve their conservation goals. A number of our teams are interested in solar. A number of them are looking at biomass as an alternative to delivered fuels. Those regional teams are part and parcel of what we do. They're the people on the ground interested in projects, and they're the people that we're working with to try to move projects forward and get them done in their communities.
Diana McEwen with the Metro region of CERTS. The only thing I guess I would add is that of the appropriation, the $500,000, $70,000 of that goes directly back to communities. Each region, other 7 regions, get $10,000 to do seed grants. And that is a process where the steering committee and others, you know, review proposals and give out little stipends, sometimes something between $1,000 and $5,000, depending on the kind of project, to really help give that piece of, you know, a financial resource in addition to the other resources that we connect communities to. And so, you know, we give that money back to those communities to move forward projects in every region of the state.
Are there any questions, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, Senator, maybe the amendment is going to address this issue, but this is a $500,000 annual assessment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, this comes from an existing assessment that's done. This is a part of the larger conservation efficiency initiative that we passed a few years ago. So this assessment is currently done for $3.6 million. So this earmarks $500,000 per year of that annual assessment that's done against utilities. So it's not a new assessment. It's just a direction of some dollars within an existing assessment.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen. This is also renewing the funding that we've had for each of the last 2 years. As Senator Dibble mentioned at the beginning, our funding had come out of the Renewable Development Fund 2 years ago as that fund was being reviewed. This was seen as a potential interim solution and has been found to be a very good fit for the work that we do. And so this would be just continuing that same course that we've been on the last 2 years.
And Senator Dibble, you want to incorporate the A1 amendment into your bill? Is that what you want to do?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, wait, not incorporate.
Pass
this
it.
Is an author's. You don't need it anymore? No? What?
I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Well, you two aren't talking to me. Okay. All right. Okay, Senator Dibble moves the author's amendment, A1. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Okay. Are there any questions on the bill? Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Dibble, I would agree with you that these guys do a really good job. I'm just wondering, is the department okay with doing the report, or do we really think that that's necessary at this point? Have they weighed in on that at all? And obviously, I'm supportive of your bill, but
right,
I just don't know.
Right.
We get plenty of reports around here.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sparks, yes, I had a conversation with the department about the report. They were wondering, is this a really detailed report, and how much work do we have to do, et cetera, et cetera. And we do say it must be brief. It's just really, I think it's important for us to know what's done with these dollars. And so I was really just looking for some accounting of how these how this assessment is spent. So even in just a simple list format, I thought would be sufficient, and they were comfortable with that.
there anybody that needs to testify on this? See anybody jumping up? Okay. Any further comments from the committee? Okay. Seeing none, then Senator Dibble moves Senate File 1011 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Marty. Around. Five, four.
is there a motion in order here, Mr. Chair? I think they're all in committees here, I think. We've got several members.
There he is.
Two, one. Oh, he just made it just in time. Senator Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We were just waiting out the door.
Senate File 901.
Senate File 901 is an omnibus energy bill, and I think about roughly half of these folks have been on the Energy Committee, Environment and Energy Policy Committee, and have been through this. Bottom line is we're working to move Minnesota's energy policies to move forward in a way that's going to help our environment and help us with our jobs and help our state economy. And the simple way I'd put what I think we're hoping to do is recognize that Minnesota spends $13 billion a year that we ship out of state and sometimes out of country to import fuels. And we'd like to replace that with Minnesota businesses and jobs. And that would be through energy efficiency and conservation. It would be through renewable energy. And this bill is an attempt to continue what we've been doing in terms of wind power and conservation and efficiency and step up those efforts and to jumpstart the solar industry. And then at the same time, start developing a stakeholder process using the Legislative Energy Commission, which many of the members of this committee serve on, to try and bring together stakeholders, everyone from utilities and business and labor and advocates, and bring the whole state together and try and figure out how we move to make Minnesota's economy more self-contained and self-sufficient in terms of energy. And Mr. Chair and members, we've been, since the bill passed out of the Environment and Energy Committee, we've been meeting repeatedly with stakeholders involved and trying to address their concerns. And I think I have an A33 amendment, which is obviously not the sense of an author's amendment that you take it because that's to put the bill in the shape I want. But this is an amendment that I think would move the bill forward. It addresses things in a number of ways. I'm going to go over some of the brief.
Senator Marty, how about if Senator Dibble moves the A33 amendment so we put it before the committee so we know what we're working off of? Okay. Senator Dibble? Okay.
I'll move.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, for discussion, this is a very significant change of 901, Senate File 901. I guess my question to you, Mr. Chair, is there are a couple people on this committee that serve on the policy committee that the senator chairs, and I'm looking at the size without diving into it totally here, but this seems to be a complete change or complete rewrite of 901, and I'm wondering if that is something that we want to get into without first having policy go through it.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, for purposes of this committee, it's okay for Senator Marty to move an amendment, have an amendment moved to change the bill. So what I think we were going to do for purposes of this committee is to listen to the explanation of the amendment and how it changes the bill. And we can make a decision as the committee moves on as to whether or not we should act on it here or if we should. And if it does need to go back to policy, that can possibly happen, I suppose, as it goes through the process. But I think for today, what I think that we should do, because Senator Marty has been working very hard with the stakeholders to try and come up with some kind of a compromise that may work for everybody, is to at least listen to what is in the amendment here, and we can act on it after that. Okay, and we have a number of people that are here today to testify also, so this could turn into a very interesting hearing, I would think, by the time we're done. So Senator Marty, maybe if Senator Ingebretson would like to let us discuss what you have in this amendment so people can understand what's in the amendment and how it differs from the bill that's in front of us. And start hearing witnesses also.
Right, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And what I was going to suggest is that I first go through the big changes in the thing. And it's not as many changes as it looks in terms of most of it. I think Senate Council felt rather than have a lot of page and line little things and explain them one by one is felt it was simpler to just do it as a delete everything and put it together. But I'll start by going through the changes in the bill, in the amendment. And again, they were changes made to accommodate the concerns that were being raised by the utilities. And just in general summary, the solar standards that were in the bill are being cut in half, and the large industrials are being removed, which would reduce it further. And then the municipal and cooperative utilities are being removed from the bill in total. The bill, as it came here, had some of the bigger changes were in the net metering cap was being raised from 40 kilowatts to a megawatt for all utilities. We removed that for the municipals and co-ops. The bill required, again, 5% that you would have 5% distributed generation, up to 5% before they could put a cap on it, and the municipals and co-ops were, again, removed from that. The value of solar, which was something the Department of Commerce has been working with, I think, for about 18 months with the utilities, trying to find a new way. It would be a buy-all, sell-all method that the utilities are interested in very much. That is not significantly changed in this bill, other than one concern the utilities had, that there was a retail there was a rate floor under the value of solar at the retail rate. We took that out of the bill. The solar standards were for the investor-owned utilities were 0.5% by 2016, 2% by 2020, and 4% by 2025. We removed the municipals and co-ops, as I mentioned earlier, for the for XL. It would be 0.5%, 1%, 2%. The other IOUs would be 0.25%, 1% and 2%. So they're and then on top of that, the large industrial plants, the paper mills, the taconite plants, and so on, would be exempted from the standards. So that if in the case in each utility, you got to understand is significantly different. And if you look at like Minnesota Power, roughly 60% of their power is being consumed by a handful of these large industrial plants. And so, in effect, they would only have, since 60% of theirs would be exempted, it would only be 40% would be applying of the standard would be applying to them. In effect, that would mean their other customers would have the same standard as XL and the others would have. The bill, as it came out of my committee, had a 1% solar incentive fund. All utilities would be collecting 1% of their gross revenues the previous year and would be collecting that for the solar incentive fund. We've removed that from the bill entirely. XL, we would be having them operate $10 million a year production incentive program that they would run with funds from the Renewable Development Fund. And the bill continues to have a provision for community solar. I'll still say this is a work in progress. I think the munis and co-ops have been exempted, but we're still trying to come up with better language on that. I'll acknowledge it's not in the shape that I think we're ready to go with, but I think it's a good provision, and I think we've asked the utilities to XL had been working. They've got a provision in Colorado. We've asked them to come back, continue working on it. Then finally, the Made in Minnesota proposal of the chair is still in the bill. We do have the Department of the Division of Energy would ensure a fair distribution of projects, and I think that may have been what you have in your bill as well. But there are a number of smaller changes, and with that, I'm happy to go through the bill section by section or however you would like to go, and then we can take testimony.
Okay. Well, it would probably be a good idea to go section by section so people understand what's going on. And so we'll be working off the A33 amendment that everybody has in front of them, I think so. Do you want to go through it, Senator Marty, or do you want the department to do it?
Mr. Chair, I'll go through it and have Bill Grant from Division of Energy Resources help me out when I'm struggling. Section one of the bill would be having the Energy Commission pull together stakeholders to develop a framework for moving Minnesota's energy transition. And Article 1 and Section 2 of that would be for the department to scope for a study, a future study, a long-term study on...
Senator Marty, I just got a quick question.
Yes.
Because I see that in Clause A that we want to get rid of fossil fuels in the next few decades. Are they going to have an idea of what they want to replace the fossil fuels?
Mr. Chair, yes. I mean, and I think the simple answer to it is that there have been studies suggesting that even with existing technologies, and I think there's a worldwide understanding that that technologies are changing very regularly. And obviously, energy storage technology, there was a new one on how hydrogen storage is picked up a couple weeks ago. Major new advancements. I think we're going to continue to see that, whether in battery and chemical storage or other types of things. But yes, that's something that this is not a next year thing. This is a 30-year type of transition, and that's why I think it's very important. As you can see in paragraph B, we'd have stakeholders, including not limited to co-ops, munis, investor owns, advocates, labor, industry, technical, scientific experts to try and figure out how. So I think the important thing is we have everybody at the table talking about it. I think that's worked well in the past before the renewable energy standards came into being. I think it's worked well with what the Division of Energy Resources has been doing. But we'd be having a study.
You can understand my concern being from where I am.
I understand your concern. We have to have power that works.
And it has to be 24 hours a day.
24/7. That's true.
And it has to be economical also.
It has to be economical as well, Mr. Chair. I fully agree. Article 2 is the distributed generation solar standard language, which was the same as in the bill in the past with a couple of minor changes. Section 2, you can see we exclude the co-ops and munis from this. The IOUs would remain at the 1 megawatt in the bill. Section 3, I think, is conforming language. Section 4 also was in the original bill. I mean, most of this has been in the original bill, so I don't want to over talk about it, but you can see on page 5 that any net sales to the utility at the end of the year would be compensated. The utility's avoided costs, not the retail costs. I think that's one of the things that the utilities figure is essential. Aggregation of meters would not be applying to cooperatives and munis. Cogeneration, Section 6, the cumulative generation, no change other than we remove the co-ops and munis. Section 7, this is something the utilities had wanted. They wanted to make sure that the distributed generation is linked to the needs of the customer. You don't want somebody making their own miniature power companies just to sell power to the utilities, so we limit it to 120% of the customer's on-site annual electric consumption. I think the remainder is, next section is conforming. Section 9, the value of solar is very similar, as I mentioned earlier, to what was in the bill. That was what the stakeholder process for the last year and a half has been working on. Utilities expressed strong concerns about a retail rate floor. We took that provision out of the bill. The solar electric standard I've already talked about in Section 10, we significantly reduced it. The Section 11, when we took out the co-ops and munis, we suggested instead we have the Energy Commission convene a group with them and try and figure out. It's no particular response, but is there a way we can incorporate solar generation into their system? It's simply getting them together to try and figure out what we might be able to do. Article 3 is the community solar provision. That hasn't changed from before. As I said, we're still working on that. Article 4, the Made in Minnesota, you're familiar with that, Mr. Chair. We were removing, as I mentioned, in removing the co-ops and munis from it. The dollar amount hasn't changed in here, but that would, I think that's the only change. Oh, I also mentioned earlier that the Division of Energy Resources is required to try and distribute it appropriately so Xcel customers aren't subsidizing others and so on. So it's basically geographically distributed because it depends where people are applying for the projects, where small projects are coming online, to make sure it's distributed in a responsible way.
And because the co-ops and the munis have been removed, then they don't qualify for the incentive.
They would not qualify for that. But yes, I think they were, when we took them out of community solar and so on, they wanted to know that they could still try and do what they want to do on their own, and we want to encourage that. Article 5, transmission recovery. I think this is one of the provisions that was requested by what was Xcel, section Article 6. You've seen that already, the CERTS funding. Article 7, energy policy savings goal. This came from Senator Dibble's bill, and I don't think there's been any change in this. Article 8 on page 28, this is a provision from Xcel, I believe, as well. Article 9 is a provision. Oh, 8 is Otter Tail. It was a coal plant that they could start billing back for a plant rate rider. This would speed it up for them.
Excuse me, Senator Marty. Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair, did we just go past the CERTS funding? We did have a little change that was not picked up.
Oh, we did go through that, Senator Dibble, but yes, you just had it 5 minutes ago, so I wasn't in the room at that time.
Okay. Mr. Chair, we just need to change online. Well, we can get to it later.
We'll do that later.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay.
Remaining, let's see, transmission. Let's see. Article 9, I don't think there's been any changes in. Article 10, I think there may have been a technical wording change. Yes, but I can't remember. I believe it was a technical change. Must include consideration of whether, and I think it was several redundant words, but it was the policy was not significantly changed there, not changed at all. Renewable integration study. This came from, we had a bigger, much broader provision being proposed. This is simply doing just the transmission study. The Article 12 is a, this is an Xcel provision, I believe. Mm-hmm. Article 13 is the PACE provisions that have not changed from the other bill. And Article 14, waste heat recovery, I believe that's the same as in the bill in the past. And Article 15, this is the provision that we were adding when we were taking out the 1% of utility bills. This would be having Xcel operate a program to provide solar incentives for residential customers. And the amount would be for 5 years, the lesser of $10 million or as much as available in the account. And that would obviously be not used if they did not have enough applicants for the program. And they are the ones who are, they are filing a plan for the program with the Commission of Commerce. And the goal is to try and see how much solar they can get out of those incentives. That's separate from your one as well, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any comments or questions? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple. Senator Marty, page one. The framework and strategy must be designed. It's, section 1.10. Framework and strategy must be designed to make Minnesota the first state in the nation to use only renewable energy. My question would be, what if another state were to, is there a time frame on that? Am I missing something there? Or is that immediate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, there is no time frame. That's a goal. We're trying to do that. We don't know what, if somebody is far more aggressive than us, I think that's possible. We would not accomplish our goal. The goal is to say we're trying to set up a framework on how we could move that way. Again, with the point that I think the chair mentioned a few minutes ago, technology is changing constantly and how we could. The technology is there to do it now. It'd be more costly, but I think it's going to be changing. I think 20 years ago when we started using wind, it was far more expensive. Now it's one of the best parts for some of the utilities.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator Marty, for that explanation, but does this not require Minnesota to be the first? So if somebody were to come up with something better 2 years from now, does that mean we're going to be off to the races here? And is this language pretty descriptive when it says we must be number one in the nation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, this is setting what our goals would be. If somebody comes up with great new technology and so on, we want to take advantage of it too. And if we're not the first, there's no penalty for anyone. This is the Legislative Energy Commission, which I know you've served on it. You have not served on it. Anyway, it's 10 members of the Senate, of which at least I think about 5, 6, 7 members of this committee are on. It's a bipartisan commission in which we are trying to bring people together, setting that as a goal. How would we do that? There is no penalty. There's no goal. This is simply a commission. And having served on a number of commissions, I know legislators don't accomplish the goals of the commission. There's no penalty or any sort. We're just trying to say, here's a marker. We'd like to be ahead of the game. And part of the reason for that, if I can step back for a second, is Germany has been moving aggressive. I think they're most aggressive of any of the countries doing this. It's an old industrial country. We know that. They've heavily reliant on fossil fuel. Like us, they import most of their fuel. They made a decision they're going to try and transition rapidly, faster than anybody else, to doing this. The German energy minister was at the University of Minnesota last year talking about how they now have 400,000 jobs in renewable energy, far more than they have in traditional fossil fuels, and he said about half the jobs are in energy exports. We're exporting our technology because they're two steps ahead. And so I'm saying, you know, this is just a goal we're aiming at. And so telling the commission, let's look at that. Let's try and do that. Because if we're one step ahead of Wisconsin and Iowa and everything, we get the industry, we get the jobs here. If we're two steps behind, we're importing from their businesses and their jobs. So it's there's no penalty for doing it. It's just telling the commission what direction we'd like them to aim.
Mr. Chair, the language then must be designed. I guess that certainly tells me that the state of Minnesota is going to be, no matter what anybody else does, we will be. Or am I not reading my bill the same as everybody here? It says we must be designed to make Minnesota the first state. That doesn't really leave a whole lot of room. We will be the first state.
Mr. Chairman?
So I'm just wondering, I understand where you want to be. I understand you want to do whatever you can. The renewable standards, I believe, in 2007 that were passed in a bipartisan fashion. In fact, Barry Swade, 64-3. As well as the Governor Pawlenty signing that bill. We were then number one, I believe, in renewable standards. So I understand, you know, whether I like it or not, I understand the want to be number one, but are we requiring Minnesota to be number one by this language? That's all I'm asking.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, no. We're requiring the commission to talk about a framework that would do that. I think the analogy I'd give is I think we'd be kind of disappointed if the Minnesota Wild said, you know, we're going to try and aim to be number three or something. Does a team always get where they want to be? No, but this is simply directing the Energy Commission to try and aim for this kind of thing. There's no penalty whatsoever.
I think we'd be pretty happy if the Wild were number three.
Just three more goals last night would have made a difference, actually. Mr. Chair, that's my point. The must be designed. We can't must the Wild to be champions. I mean, we'd love to for that to happen, but we are making them champions here. Am I not? Is the word must?
Senator Marty, maybe explain that clause again. And
sure, Mr. Chair, maybe some words like should be aimed at, if that would make you happier. Again, this is a commission, a legislative commission, just telling them what direction we're trying to aim at. Okay, I'm happy to talk with you about the words.
Sure.
About
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just read this as aspirational language, you know, for a framework and a strategy. We're all familiar with the MCAG report that was commissioned by Governor Pawlenty that was supposed to get us on the path towards our 80% reduction goal in carbon dioxide. How much of that has come to pass? Almost none of it. So, I mean, you know, we put these aspirational statements in statute, and, you know, it all depends on our willingness in the future to follow the framework and the strategy. So it's aspirational language that has no real force and effect. We'll see what the inclination of future legislatures is.
Senator Osmond, you were next. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Marty, Germany seems to be brought up a couple of different times, and I'm curious what the differences in rates are between Germany and America and Minnesota. I think the German rates are significantly higher than ours, which I guess I'd question how much we want to be like Germany, because I don't think 25 cents a kilowatt hour is necessarily the thing Minnesotans are going to want.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmond, as you and I know, Germany has, all of Europe has much higher utility rates than we have. I'm not trying to say we should copy, one, either everything Germany's done nor their rate structure or anything of that sort. I'm not making that case. I'm saying that we want to, right now we are shipping a lot of money out of our state economy, and we want to convert that to jobs in the state, and I think we can do that. I think that's why we have strong support from folks from labor and industry who feel they can make a lot of businesses grow in Minnesota with this and stop exporting fuel dollars.
Mr. Chair, I think, just in conclusion, I think I understand your comment about having something aspirational, but we're talking about a state policy, and I know that if you don't have a goal, you're just practicing, but I get very concerned about aspirational language as opposed to actually policy that we're going to initiate and have the absolute intentions on accomplishing.
Senator Dibble, do you have your hand up?
No.
No. Okay. Got you already. Okay. Okay. Mr. Grant, if there's no more comments from the Senator Ingebrigtsen.
One more question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Senator Marty, 23.30, I see the utility to recover charges. Can you explain that to me, where they're going to recover the charges? And I'm not mistaken, I think that might be throughout the bill here. Just real quickly, because I have not been on that committee, and who's going to, it's on page 23, I'm sorry.
Yes,
Senator Ingebrigtsen, this is for Otter Tail. They have a power plant that it's an expensive thing, and they have not been able to assess their folks yet, and won't be for a couple more years. This would speed it up, and they believe this would be a lot easier for their ratepayers. So, Mr. Logue from Otter Tail is here. He'll be testifying later. He could give you more details.
So the ratepayers will be paying for it.
Yes, that's
thank
true.
You. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, Bill Grant from the Minnesota Department of Commerce. As Senator Marty has alluded, the department, through our Division of Energy Resources, has been working over the last 18 months with stakeholders on a good section of this bill. What we heard starting day one of our administration was that there were a growing number of consumers in Minnesota that wanted to generate their own electricity. They wanted to take advantage of the fact that technology costs have fallen rapidly, and frankly, they want to get ahead of the curve on having their own energy systems for reliability purposes. What we found when we looked into Minnesota's current policies was that of the 44 states, for example, that have net metering policies in place, we were number 44 in terms of the amount of capacity.
Why don't you explain to the committee what net metering is?
Of course, Mr. Chairman. Net metering is a policy that's been in place in Minnesota since 1981, and it allows customers to interconnect with the utility system for the purpose of generating their own electricity, but remaining interconnected so that energy can be provided to them when their own systems aren't operating. When they are generating, and if they're producing excess electricity, they are, in effect, spinning the meter backwards so that they're getting their own usage offset by the system that's providing power to them on site. And so we've had that policy in place for a number of years. The policy has rewarded those customers for producing excess electricity by paying them the retail rate for excess electricity. That's one of the things that we heard during our workshops over the last 18 months was a concern for utilities, which is why in this bill, after January 1st, 2015, that rate drops back to the utility's avoided cost, a much lower rate than the retail rate. So that's what net metering is. So the governor's bill really does three things before other provisions were added to it through the omnibus process. First, it reforms the net metering policies that we currently have in place by raising the net metering cap from the currently quite low level of 40 kilowatts to 1,000 kilowatts. Secondly, we, as I said, changed the reimbursement rate from the retail rate to the avoided the utility's avoided cost. Secondly, we developed with stakeholders this value of solar alternative tariff. One of the things that we learned talking with a municipal utility in Texas was that their program had been enhanced by converting their net metering program to this value of solar approach. And basically what that means is we're going to take a look at what the actual value of solar generated electricity is to the utility and use that quantified, that monetized amount for the rate that we will pay consumers instead of using the net metering approach. The utilities favor this approach over net metering because it helps them capture the fixed costs of serving those customers. So that's the second thing our bill did. And then the third thing was that we did have language for a solar standard in our bill. We didn't indicate when we had our bill introduced at what threshold we felt that that standard should be. We felt it was better that we arrive at a standard through discussions with the stakeholders and legislators through the legislative process. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the bill that was the vehicle for the omnibus bill that's in front of you now, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
So, Mr. Grant, when you say the solar standard to arrive at, is that what's in the amendment?
Well, I, Mr. Chairman and members, I think you could say that, yes, that through the discussions that we've been having around here over the last couple of months, we're now at the level that's currently in the bill.
And we refers to?
refers to the utilities, both the cooperative utilities, municipal utilities, investor-owned, the solar industry, solar installers, environmental advocates. Those were the main groups that were involved.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Grant, avoided cost, about what? Is that what is that number compared to the retail rate?
Sure. Mr. Grant. Mr. Chairman and Senator Westrom, current retail rate is anywhere from 8 to 10 cents a kilowatt hour. Current avoided cost is in the 2 to 3 cent a kilowatt hour range.
And while you're at it, why don't you explain for the committee avoided cost and how they arrive at that figure?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Grant. Chairman and Senator Westrom. Avoided cost is a term that simply means what would it cost to generate the next kilowatt hour of electricity from whatever the next technology would be that we would be using to do that. So, for example, we might peg avoided cost to the cost of adding a new natural gas-fired power plant to the system. That would be the cost you're avoiding by, in this case, generating electricity with solar electricity or conserving that same kilowatt hour. That's the concept of avoided cost.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Grant, if you're avoiding cost from a current power plant, isn't that lower than if you're avoiding the cost of having to build something new or a peak power that you're buying on the grid?
Mr. Grant?
Or is there no difference?
Mr. Chairman, generally speaking, yes, you're right, Senator Westrom, that, but not always. At this time, the existing system costs are probably higher than what you could go and buy power from the grid, because power costs are quite low and the grid is currently net surplus in terms of generating capacity. So avoided cost today is lower than it's been for a while. Another contributing factor is the currently low cost of natural gas. It makes it cheaper to build the next unit of capacity than to operate the current system.
And one last question here, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grant, so how would we figure avoided cost in this new net metering? I mean, would they go off of the companies? Would there be a standard rate, or where would they come from? With your last testimony, I mean, if they actually could go on the grid and buy it cheaper than what they're currently operating, how do we establish that avoided cost, and how does somebody putting up a project know what that's going to reap them in payments if they have more power generated than what they need for their usage?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, we haven't changed anything about the way that avoided cost is calculated in the bill. And avoided cost has been something that has been calculated and filed with the Public Utilities Commission every year since the early 80s, and we're not changing anything about that computation. And it's a utility by utility computation and then approved by the commission.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. Any further comments or questions of this witness? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're going to stick around.
Mr. Chair,
go ahead. Go ahead, Senator Westrom.
Mr. Grant, you made the comment we're 44 out of 44 states. What do you mean by that with net metering laws? I didn't fully follow that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, thanks for the question. There are 44 states that have net metering policies in place right now. We've looked at where Minnesota ranks in terms of the amount of generating capacity that's been created through net metering policies. And of the 44 states that have net metering, we're last, dead last, in terms of the amount of generating capacity that we have that's the result of net metering.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to drag this on, but I think it's important and it's news for me. What would be the reasons for that? And here's criticism I hear of our current net metering is people game the system and they're actually selling power for retail back to the utilities that they don't use and they're making money on it. If that was true, why wouldn't we have more people subscribing to it? And let me give you the flip side. Is it that most people don't want to do that and they truly want to produce their own power and hook up to the grid? And by capping it at 40 kW, we've inadvertently kept that low, but even though we offer a generous rate up to the first 40 kW, it still doesn't make sense and people don't do it. And if we raise the cap and lower less money or pay more money, there's a bigger subscription. There's a lot in that question, but any reaction to that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, we did look at where our net metering cap was relative to states around the country that have net metering policies, and ours is at the low end of the spectrum of where the caps are. And it's our belief that is one of the reasons that we've had such a poor response to our net metering policies is because really at 40 kW, only residential and very small businesses can take advantage of it. What we've excluded is the opportunity for medium and larger size businesses to take advantage of net metering.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Grant, when it comes to renewables, out of those 44 states, where does Minnesota rank?
Mr. Grant.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I can break it down by all renewables. I know that recently Minnesota fell from number 5 to number 7 in terms of total wind capacity installed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Grant. All right. Betsy Engelking, are you here? Say your name for the record in case I butchered it.
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Betsy Engelking, and I am Vice President with Geronimo Energy. For those of you who aren't familiar with Geronimo Energy, we are a utility-scale wind and solar developer based in Edina, Minnesota. We were founded by a southwestern Minnesota farmer who believed that solar and wind needed to be developed in a way that was compatible with the land and with the agricultural use of the land. I'm here today to urge your support for Senate File 901 as it's been amended. The bill will allow Minnesota to get a head start on creating jobs that come with the solar industry, very similar to what we did with the wind industry in the last decade. This job is carefully balanced between the Made in Minnesota incentive, the small solar incentive, and a reasonable, achievable solar standard to support jobs in the entire supply chain, from manufacturing to installation to construction and to operations and maintenance. It's also very efficiently designed to support all sectors of the solar industry. Solar is distributed. It can be small and it can be large. It can go on residential housetops. It can go on acres in a field. And this bill very carefully supports each sector of this industry, all of which are important for the jobs that we're creating in Minnesota. Geronimo Energy and many other energy companies stand ready, companies that operate in Minnesota already, stand ready to bring cost-effective solar and its wide range of jobs to Minnesota now. The costs of solar are dropping very, very rapidly. The costs of solar are very compatible with the peak rates in Minnesota at the time. And I strongly urge you to support the bill. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions or comments? Okay, thank you, Ms. Engel. Dustin Dennison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators, my name is Dustin Dennison. I'm a board member with the Minnesota Renewable Energy Society, with the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association, and principal owner of a solar development company, Applied Energy Innovations. Of those three titles, the most important is as a jobs creator with Applied Energy Innovations. I have three brief points I'd like to make to convey as we gather here on Earth Day. These three points revolve around good public policy and jobs. Number one, every year we create good public policy and bad public policy. The definition often defined between philosophical differences, but most times it's about common sense. Good public policy is the headlines that our utilities, Xcel, our munis, our co-ops, get to share. And I give you four examples. Example A, headlined February 19th, 2007. Minnesota legislature passes the strongest renewable energy standard to be signed into law by Governor Tim Pawlenty. Example B, headlines March 19th, 2013. Xcel hits upper Midwest wind power record. Another example, good public policy and creating jobs. Example C, headlines, February 18th, Xcel Energy mercury emissions reduction, quote, a remarkable achievement. Good public policy and creates jobs. And quote, we at Xcel Energy recognize and really appreciate the partnerships among regulators, utilities, customers, environmental advocates, and other stakeholders that made possible the significant reductions in mercury in the state of Minnesota, said Xcel Energy Regional Vice President Laura McCartan. And I respond, that's another example, good public policy, creating jobs. My last example, this one from Colorado. Colorado solar gardens open up for business, sell out in 30 minutes. During that time, Xcel received applications for three times the solar PV capacity allowed under current state law, which was only 4.5 megawatts. Quote, the success of this initial offering and the fact that it subscribed so quickly clearly shows that this is a beneficial and desirable program for our Colorado customers, and we are pleased with the interest shown today. And this was, again, quote, Excel subsidiary public service company, David Eves, president and CEO. Another example, good public policy in creating clean energy jobs. My second point is that there is a majority electric here today, and that has been empowered by their constituents. Based on shared values of principles and convictions, I urge you today to listen to those voices, those that have elected you, those that have been outside our council chambers here, and that of the governor, to keep our state on a pathway of clean energy jobs and good public policy. My last point I would like to make speaks to the heart of why we are here today, to create good public policy. And it is the passion-fueled debates, testimony, and often individuals who hold picket signs, write letters, sign postcards, erect banners, and put their lives on hold to champion the issues they care deeply about. The Energy Omnibus Bill, Senate File 901, is good public policy, and it will create jobs. I ask for your support today, on Earth Day, that we create our own headlines, and we continue to create good public policy in the state of Minnesota, and that we create jobs. Thank you. I'm available for any questions.
Thank you. Any comments or questions? Senator Sacktock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dennis, I certainly don't argue with you on how wind energy has helped us with the renewable energy and that it's very clean energy, but can you give me any examples, but can you fill me in on the amount of jobs that we're talking about here that provided?
And that wind or solar?
Wind. But you can segue into solar, but I mean, we were promised lots of jobs off of wind energy. So,
And I would have to respond, Senator. I don't know the exact number on the amount of jobs created by the wind turbines. I would hypothesize with the hundreds of turbines that were erected and the scale of engineering and construction for each individual turbine that this created thousands of jobs. And as a segue into solar, I can give you an example of one simple commercial project that we do. It takes designers, it takes engineers, it takes people at our municipal permitting offices, it takes inspectors to come out, it takes the crane operator, it takes the apprentice that helps learn how to operate that crane, it takes designers from my staff, it takes the manufacturers here locally in Minnesota that create the products that we install. It takes those jobs, and it takes the installers and electricians to put those systems on our roofs. That's just for one job. And we would like to support that model, and we would like to create thousands of jobs. And I believe we can do that, this bill.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Dennison, again, I'm not questioning that, and it seems like we should be able to produce those solar panels in the state of Minnesota. But I'm back to wind when, you know, the same scenario kind of came before us. And I don't know how many manufacturers of wind turbines are there in the state of Minnesota.
You know, Senator Sacktock, I'm not a wind expert on this part. I can't give you that answer.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sacks, I think one of the people who would most be helpful at that, Bill Haney from Electrical Workers, he sent us a letter here, by the way, and he's unfortunately out of town, and he said that he wants to remind people that there's still a lot of building trades folks who are on the bench from the recession, and we want to jumpstart this. But I think that our next witness is from Steelworkers, and they've been heavily involved in that. I don't know if he has any numbers, but we will get you numbers on the jobs because it is in certain parts of the state, it's a huge industry.
Mr. Well, Chair.
Who said that?
Thank you.
Mr. Dennison? Okay.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Oh, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
I'm sorry, were you done?
I am. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dennison, for that. And No, I think it's fair to say that there's 67 of us in the Senate that think Earth Day is every day here in Minnesota. And if we don't, I think we're really not thinking too much of our kids and our grandkids' future. But let's talk about the headline that I did read, 20% reduction of the carbon footprint in the United States. Part of that has to do with natural gas. What's your comments on that?
I think natural gas is obviously another viable technology that's out there. I don't think when we look at an aggregate number of all the different energy producing avenues that we have, we can say one is best over the other. I think what we're asking for, most importantly in this bill, is that we're able to put solar in the mix and that we should give our ratepayers, give our customers an option. You can have energy produced by coal, nuclear, wind. Why not solar? We've empowered those decisions. I think it's an opportunity that we continue and we extend to say we can create those clean jobs with solar. The direct answer with gas, it is an emerging market that's out there. I believe personally, once it becomes a commodity on the global market and individuals figure out how to ship gas, natural compressed gas, I think we're going to see this in the global market and our costs are going to go up.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, and thank you for acknowledging that. I did read that somewhere, and it was quite astounding to me that natural gas was not getting any credit. I'm certainly not going to sit here and tell you that they're getting the reason why we have a 20% reduction. But just to finish up, I appreciate what you folks have done here today and all the concerns that you have, and at the same time, just understand we all care here, and we really do. And quite frankly, Minnesota's been doing a very good job, I think. And moving forward, it's questionable whether we, you know, how much more we want to pay. That's where we're at. And appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Senator Weber.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dennison, right now there are substantial programs out there, even on the national basis, that give tax credits and subsidies out there for the solar, and isn't, but it hasn't. While there's been some movement, it hasn't really, I would say, progressed at a really fast rate. And can you offer a suggestion as to why that is? And does part of it still stem as far as it's the inefficiency of production?
Yes, Senator Weber. I would have to address this. As an example, when we look at the popularity of solar as an option, Xcel Solar Rewards Program opened up on March 11th after a three-month delay. By that day, by our account, after our company, along with the rest of the solar installers in the state of Minnesota, the end of that day, I believe there's 444 applications for projects, both commercial and residential. I believe it was only 7 days after that, the numbers we heard, there was over 800 applications for solar renewable energy projects. I believe that those rebates, those credits, the incentives that you talk about have helped to put a footing underneath solar energy, and they continue to. As we have seen the cost from when we originally installed 3 years ago, systems that are now almost a third, if not half, the cost than they were 3 years ago.
Senator Martin.
Mr. Chair, they had handed out from Wind on the Wires job numbers for wind jobs in Minnesota. And at the bottom, you can see their estimates are a 250 megawatt wind farm. A large farm would be over 1,000 jobs created. But that was handed out, and Mr. Sullivan's here if Senator Saxog wanted to follow up to his questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Marty, this is fine. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Weber.
For follow up, but at this point in time, would you say it's safe to say that the only reason that, are you saying then that the only reason that solar is popular is because we're subsidizing it?
No. I would say we've noticed, even after the rebates have been oversubscribed, we do continue to sell systems without rebates. We continue to sell systems for people that have a passion, those being both business owners residential property owners to have renewable energy on their property.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Weber.
And follow up on that, what would you say are the, in terms of the systems then, percentage-wise, how many systems are going out due to the subsidization, how many are going out on their own without it?
That's a great question. And I think if, that opportunity were proposed to anybody that saw there was an opportunity for a rebate of 40, 50, or 60% on their system, that's obviously motivating a lot of sales on that. That percentage is quite large.
But to follow up on that, what would be the difference?
The difference?
Yeah.
I would say on systems that receive tax credits, rebates, incentives, you might have a market share that is 70, 80% fueled. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing or that that's an evil. That shows us that we are putting programs in place that work. It shows us that we are putting an industry on the map that creates products in the Minnesota marketplace, and it creates jobs. And someday we're going to have an industry that probably won't have subsidies. And I think we're going to also see the cost at that point and the products we manufacture, the products that we install, even at a fraction of the cost they are today. But I think when we look at public policy in the past, to get any industry moving forward, we've always created some sort of subsidy to get it going.
Any other questions of the witness? Okay, thank you, Mr. Dennison.
Bob Ryan.
And Mr. Chair, while Mr. Ryan's coming up, I wanted to say on that point, solar costs have been dropping dramatically in the last 3-4 years. And I think one of the reasons our bill only has solar standards going up to 2025 is we think by that time we're going to be hitting the point where the cost, because of the continuing cost decline, is going to put it into the point where we're going to be moving out of the subsidies because we've gotten the market to take off and the cost is falling.
And just remind me, solar does count in the renewable standard that we already have in Minnesota, right?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Ryan.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Bob Ryan. I work for the United Steelworkers District 11 in Minnesota and 8 other states. Prior to that, I want to make it clear from other testimony. For 32 years, I worked in a paper mill in St. Paul. So somebody once made a comment that it's just union people in here. No, I worked labor hard. Steelworkers, we're the largest manufacturer in North America. We represent 13,000 members in Minnesota alone in the iron ore mines, paper mills, manufacturing facilities, oil, and healthcare facilities across Minnesota. I'm also here representing the Blue Green Alliance, and I'm joined in this hearing room by some others from our 10 national labor organizations, including Steve Viter sitting over here. He'll be speaking from Education Minnesota, and 4 national environmental organizations. I'm here today to urge you to vote in favor of Senate File 901 as amended. Minnesota Clean Energy and Jobs Campaign has come together this year with more than 60 labor, faith, environmental, industrial, youth, and conversation groups to enact legislation that will increase our state's commitment to renewable energy, to support and create good jobs for working Minnesotans, and to protect the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the land we live on. This legislation will move us further toward this goal. 6 years ago, the people in our state came together in a bipartisan way to pass landmark legislation that established 20% by 2025 renewable energy standard. But now it's time to take it to the next step. While the Clean Energy Jobs Coalition supports 40% renewables by 2030 and a 10% solar standard, this bill moves us toward this goal with an even more modest solar energy standard. Such a standard will existing RES to produce more local renewable energy, create food, good family-supporting jobs, and clean out our air. The standard is key to creating more solar manufacturing and installation jobs. The Solar Energy Jobs Act will create jobs in fields including construction, installation, design, engineering, manufacturing, training, marketing, and financing. While the Blue-Green Alliance and USW support the goals of the Made in Minnesota program in this bill, on its own, it's not enough to create new jobs and help Minnesota become a real leader. But what's more, over 100 Minnesota businesses already work across all these facets of the solar industry. Passing a solar energy standard will not only bolster these companies, but also attract new businesses to invest in one of the state's fastest-growing markets. I also want to acknowledge and give my appreciation to Senator Marty for working with us to acknowledge the energy and global competitiveness issues faced by our taconite mines and the paper mills, exempting their energy use from the standard, but putting forward a study in a stakeholder process to identify ways helping make them more competitive through reducing energy, water, and waste. There was comments before about the wind industry and the United Steelworkers. We fully support the wind industry, and to fully understand why we support it, just look at as far as its components. Typical wind turbine requires 250 tons of steel, thousands of tons of concrete, about 20 miles of copper wire, and multiple control systems, and all up to 8,000 parts. The taconite mines in Minnesota, that's the first base for that steel, for that windmill. While increasing our commitment to clean, renewable energy, which this bill does, we will create and support good jobs, drive demand for renewables and their production here in Minnesota, and protect our most cherished air, land, and water. The steelworkers have long held a commitment to environmental protection, and as a Minnesotan, I care deeply about preserving the environment for the next generation, and this bill will help us get it there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan. I think Senator Saxhog's point was that there's 10 windmills on the Iron Range, and none of the steel was American-made and came from outside the country, and I think that's maybe one of the concerns here is that a mandate ends up bringing a whole bunch of Chinese panels in, and I'd love to make them.
I have a problem with that, Senator, and you know that.
I know. Okay.
That's why the Viking Stadium has 100% American steel.
Yeah, that's good. All right. Okay. Okay. Any questions of Mr. Ryan? Okay. Thank you. Steve Vetter. Welcome to the committee.
Well,
say your name
good afternoon,
for the record.
Chairman and committee members. I just want to thank you for this opportunity to meet with you here today. My name is Steve Yater, and I teach the electrical, the wind, and the solar PV program at Riverland Community College in Albert Lea, Minnesota. I'm here representing a number of groups, Minnesota Education Association, the United Steelworkers, and also I want to, in a way, represent the job industry that we see in southern Minnesota. The program that we have down there has been placing students in the wind industry for the last 3 years. We've also opened up solar PV programs, and I can say that we've been placing students in the solar PV field also. But what's really unique about it is I think it's important to see the types of jobs that are being created. It's easy to think of that wind farm and those 60 or 70 turbines out there. But the incentives that were created here not only help build that wind farm, but you can also realize, I think, indirectly the jobs that were developed also from that. We have people that are supplying those wind farms with petroleum, lubricant, electrical components. There's a continual flood of materials that go in there with the emphasis that it's been put on O&M today. So the reality is it's not just the jobs at the wind farm, it's not just the jobs, the O&M jobs that you see out there. These incentives have created a growth industry that is really being represented as far as a workforce on the turbines, but a workforce that's supporting those turbines. And the other thing that you should really take a close look at is the different areas is the tax incentives that are coming back to the townships, the counties. That's pretty amazing when you look at that. One thing that I've always been amazed at is the students and their parents that come into our classroom, our school, and want to talk about those programs. And Mr. Chairman, committee members, I want you to realize that we're dealing with people that come in the door and they're the choir. They're already convinced that green energy is the future. They want to be part of it. They want to grow with that green energy field. And I really see this as a timely mission in a sense here. I think we're at a point where we need to provide those types of incentives to solar PV. So I'm in support myself and my students that are joining me here today. I'm in support of file 901, and I also think it's very, I think it's very much appreciated by myself and my students, the hard work that so many of the grassroots organizations have put together, Senator Marty, the industry that actually, when I talk about the industry, the renewable industry, that realizes the good-paying jobs, the jobs with good opportunities for advancement. And I think that's why anytime there's a chance like this to come up and speak about the opportunities that we have out there, I'd be more than happy to address that.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, question I've got. You work with PV, teaching it. I assume you understand PV quite well. Photovoltaic is the process of making electricity from solar energy.
Solar photovoltaic, PV.
Yeah, PV is a photovoltaic. Solar thermal is the conversion of solar energy to hot water.
Right.
They tell me that the solar thermal is quite a bit more efficient than PV. PV is a lot more expensive. That generally seems to be true, and I'll just ask for your comment. But what can be done to make PV more efficient, or are we as efficient as can be, and is it one of those things that PV is a direct transfer and there's no ways to make PV more efficient? Because with the cost of it today, tell me what the promise is for bringing those prices down, or are we just going to be at 16 or 20 or 25 cents a kilowatt if you use photovoltaic?
Mr. Vieira.
Well, we're at a point right now, we could actually, I best identify this as a leading edge on technology. We're seeing that. Just to give you an idea about cost, in 2007, we installed our first solar PV system, and that was a 1,200-watt system that ended up costing roughly right around about $800 to $1,400 by the time we got done with all the related support poles and equipment. And I want you to know that 2 years ago, we installed 3,500-watt system for under $12,000. So
what were the first prices? You said $800 to $1,400. What?
The first system that we installed was a 1,200 watt system, and that was $14,000 by the time we got done with the related wiring poles and all the support equipment.
Okay.
And now we installed
a little over $10 a watt.
Well, actually, and that is come down. That was excessively high because of the poles that we mounted that on. That was at the J.C. Hormel Nature Center in Austin, and we mounted that high enough off the ground so that no one could come in contact with it. So we had some real tremendous costs there. But maybe a better way to kind of relate to the cost right now today of solar PV, something I'd like you to think about is that right now, if you wanted to put solar PV on your roof, you'd be looking at a 240-watt module. That module will cost you between $210 to $270. And that $270 module is an American-built module. So you're looking at, that's an individual module. You're looking at that range, 210 to 270. And then you're looking at, in most communities, you've got a utility rebate that's being sponsored by that SIP funding, that conservation in practice. For example, southern Minnesota, why all of a sudden there's such a big interest about solar? Austin Utilities has come up with a dollar a watt rebate. So on that 240-watt module, you're going to receive $240 from the utilities. On top of that, you've got your 30% tax incentive. And then, of course, we know that right now, businesses, commercial, industrial, they're very much interested in this. And a commercial, industrial, agricultural setting right now qualifies for a five-year depreciation. And about 80% of that solar can be depreciated in the first year. And now, just in the last month, we found out that there is a USDA grant that's come out for solar. So what we're getting at the school is many of these people are realizing that on a when I say at the school, the inquiries that are coming in from the public that want to install solar PV, basically they're starting to realize that this is an investment that I can make and show almost a five-year payback. You know, so it's an exciting time, I really think, from the standpoint of where the industry is going.
So sir, if I can ask, $240 for that module,
mm-hmm.
that's not a panel? What is the difference between
that would be the module. That would be the panel.
That would be a panel.
And that's 240 watts. So depending on the size of the system you're looking at, you know, you'd add or you'd install multiple modules. That's not the end there as far as converting. The solar PV modules create DC. You have to have an inverter that will change the DC to AC. In our homes and businesses, we use AC. So there is a standalone inverter that can be used, or today, very inexpensive microinverters are being marketed today. They're installed right on the back of the modules. And that's actually what you'll see probably out here on the Capitol grounds very shortly. I'm sure you're going to be seeing grid-tied solar PV electric car charging stations. And those systems, when you look at the module, you figure the solar PV module is going to run you, you know, it's going to cost you between $210 to $240, and that's without the incentives. And then you're going to have to buy the inverter, the microinverter. That's about another $120. It's pretty cost-effective to put one of these systems together. One of the biggest hang-ups right now is the balance, what we refer to as the balance of systems, the racking, the mounting equipment. That's still high. And at Riverland, we're starting a project in conjunction with Mankato State University. We're entering into a collaboration. We're working on bringing the price of that racking, that balance of system, all that mounting hardware, bringing that down. That's one of the big projects that we're working on right now. Currently, we're working with Austin Utilities, preparing to install the school, Riverland, preparing to work with them to put in a couple of solar PV grid-tied electric vehicle charging stations. Communities all along Interstate 90, Interstate 35, are seeing this as an opportunity to pull people off the interstate. They'll literally be able, as they're driving down the road, pull this information up about a charging station up ahead. They'll be able to pull into a shopping mall on these level 2 chargers, charge their vehicle in 2 hours, and spend some time at the local mall. We see an interest in that.
So back to kind of the question. What is driving up the cost of PV if it sounds like the modules are not that expensive, but that must not be the big part. Why do we hear 16 and 20 plus cents a kilowatt for cost of solar PV, and that's just two to four times the price of retail electricity. You follow? I'm just trying to figure out how can we bring those costs down, or the modules and the solar conversion isn't where the expense is. If that's not the case, where is the expense?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, I think the point is all of these provisions, I mean, everything from the modules, the network that goes along with it, it all costs money. It's all coming down as we get efficiency. And I think what he's saying is that he and his students and others, as they're getting jobs and the industry grows, that's one of the reasons the efficiency is coming along. And that's one of the reasons we've had solar panels and all the rest of the systems coming down. As it gets more efficient, the more of it we do. That's why we're trying to do a little bit of jump start now, because it is continuing to fall, and it will be very competitive now. There's already been one filing at the PUC for a plan to try and compete with gas peaking plants right now. So, I mean, it's falling and it's continued. There was huge drop-off in price in the last couple of years. It's going to go slower now. The projections are that the price will continue to decline at a slower rate than the last few years, but it's getting to become competitive.
So, Senator Marty, or to the witness, how low could we reasonably expect it to get? I mean, with this being the perfect storm to help create the market and bring down those costs, what could we reasonably look at it at 5 cents a kilowatt commercially deployed, 4 cents a kilowatt, 10 cents? Just any idea,
Mr. Chairman and Senator Westrom. Again, Bill Grant for the department. The projections are that solar generated electricity will be at grid parity, or roughly the cost of generating electricity from other sources within 5 to 10 years. So that's the current projection. And I think a lot of that is based on the cost of larger PV systems, but it will be a mix, obviously, of large and smaller systems.
So, Mr. Grant, would that be parity being the avoided cost of the utilities?
Parity being the cost, the average system cost of electricity on the utility system now.
All right, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Vieter. Any more? Are there any further questions of this witness? Margaret Hodnick is next on my list. I'm just going to go down the list of testifiers I have here in no particular order. Welcome to the committee. Say your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Tomasoni and committee members. My name is Margaret Hodnick, and I'm the Vice President of Regulatory and Legislative Affairs for Minnesota Power. We appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon. We also appreciate Senator Marty's efforts to work with all stakeholders on Senate File 901, including Minnesota Power, and appreciate the Senator's refinements to the bill, including things like removing the retail rate floor and the value of solar, removing the incentive tax, and adding things like size to load provisions in the current revision. We still have concerns, however, and they center around the solar standard that appears in this bill. Our globally competitive large industrial customers are exempted, as the Senator mentioned, and about 60 to 70% of our energy is sold to those customers, and they employ thousands of people in northeastern Minnesota. So it's very important that their product remain competitive, and for that reason, we're very glad that they're out of the solar standard, because when we do estimates on what the solar standard will do to our customers' rates, and this is across the board, large industrial, residential, commercial, we project a 10 to 15% rate increase due to the solar standard. And if that rate increase isn't good for our large industrial customers, we don't think it's good for our residential and commercial customers either. We hear from all of our customers about their rates. They care about the economics. We understand from our customer research that they don't mind us doing environmental improvements like adding wind and things like that, but they also want their rates kept reasonable. And we could add wind energy instead of solar energy to meet this standard, and we could do it at 3 cents a kilowatt hour, which is, like I said, if we did it with solar, would be 10 to 15% higher. And so if we've got the wind resource and that's renewable, why wouldn't we use that? We think the solar standard forces bad resource planning decisions. Resource planning in the state of Minnesota has been done on a basis of what's the lowest cost that can be arrived at while meeting certain parameters, such as renewables. And this would take us away from that foundation. Just if you look at our system and you removed our large power customers from the solar standard, then we're composed a lot like a municipal or a co-op with our remaining customers. And I'll point out that in this bill, municipals and co-ops have been exempted. So while our large customers are protected from the solar standard, what's left is our residential and commercial, which is like a municipal co-op, and they've been exempted. One other point I want to make about this is that Article 2, Section 11 contains a study of solar policy with regard to municipals and co-ops, and I'm just going to read briefly. There's a few points of what the study would cover. It's on Section 11, Article 2, line 11.33. The study would cover the comparative cost and value of solar and other generation resources, the need for new generation resources and timing of that need, the ownership, siting, sizing, pricing, and interconnection of solar generation, and the integration of solar generation with conservation and other generation resources. These four items are pretty much exactly what we would be studying for any resource that we would want to bring onto our system. And we don't understand why we would skip those steps in adding a resource to our system and be under a mandate for solar energy. If these things are wise to look at in terms of any customer base, whether it's municipal, co-op, or whatever, it seems to me it would make sense to do this study as well for investor-owned utilities before jumping in and creating a particular type of renewable energy standard as we have with solar. So with that, I'll close my remarks. That is our main concern with the bill at this time, and I'm available to answer any questions, and thank you.
So the 40% that you're talking about, is there a calculation on that increase to the small businesses and homeowners, or have you figured that out?
Excuse me, Senator, or Chair Tomasoni. We studied the impact of the solar standard across our customer base, large industrial, residential, and commercial, and for all of those classes, the increase would be between 10 and 15%. So the residential and commercial rates would be affected 10 to 15% by this solar standard.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm just Ms. Hodnick. When you say when you exempt your large industrials and then you look like a union, are you just talking about the size of your customer base and class? Or what are you referring to when you say that?
I'm referring to the provision in Senator Marty's bill, and Senator Dibble and Chair Tomasoni, excuse me. I'm referring to the provision in Senator Marty's bill. I'm not familiar with what page it's on.
It's on line 10.9.
No, Mr. Chair, I'm just you say that when you take out your large industrial customers from the standard, Minnesota Power is like a muni and a co-op. But what does that mean?
Chair Tomasoni and Senator Dibble, what I mean is if our large industrial customers are exempted from the solar standard, then their kilowatt hours and their presence is removed, and what remains are our residential and commercial customers. And because we don't have a large metropolitan area like Xcel Energy does, we're more like a Great River Energy or a municipal system that has smaller businesses and smaller towns and cities and that type of thing. That was the analogy I was trying to draw.
Mr. Chair, okay, thanks, that helps. I thought you were referring to the way your business operates.
No, sorry.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hodnick, so I'm a little confused. If the total pie is what Minnesota Power has for its total sales of electricity right now, and you take out the iron mining and the wood products industry, do the rest of your customers have to, you take that piece of pie out, do the rest of your customers have to take the whole pie, or?
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, the way the bill would work, as Ms. Hodnick said, the large industrials, which is about, if it's 60% for Minnesota Power, they would have their goal, as you can see on the pay line above that, for 2016 is 0.25%. They would have to meet, if it's 60% exempted from it, they'd have to meet 40% of that 0.25%, or about ninth of the percent. And and the large industrials would not be paying. So they would have the same, their other customers would have the same as the other investor owns. And Bloomberg spoke, and we had a financial person from Bloomberg here a few month ago or so, and their projection was for 0.5% that would have an impact of a 0.33% average impact on a 0.33% impact on the rate. So I don't know, the 10-15% they're coming up with, Bloomberg is saying it'd be a fraction of that, but I understand we can look at numbers again as well.
Senator Saxon.
Mr. Chair, could I do an oral amendment?
Right away?
No, I mean,
we
I'm willing to wait. I was just going to do it. It's right on that area that we're talking to.
Why don't we get through the testifiers first? We'll talk about that. Okay. Ms. Hodnick, was Senator Marty's explanation the same as you were going to say to the answer, or do you not have an opinion on Senator Saxhog's question?
About how the customers would be removed from the, yeah. Yes, it is the same. It would be the 40% that's remaining would be a base of kilowatt hours that would be used to multiply times the standard, the 0.25 or the 1% or the 2% as it goes up.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions of Ms. Hodnick? Okay. Thank you very much. Ms. Annette Henkel. Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Annette Hinkle, and I'm with the Minnesota Utility Investors. We are a statewide grassroots organization of nearly 27,000 members. And you've heard about the electric co-ops and the munis and how difficult a solar mandate would be on them and their customers. You've heard about how the significant financial hit a solar mandate would be on the big electric users, and they've also been carved out. But what I want to do today is, just a moment, put a face on the people that will be significantly harmed by a portion of this proposed legislation, and that is our members. Most of you know who our members are. You've been at a lot of our meetings. Where are the Main Street, Ma-Pa retail shareholders, predominantly older, mostly retired folks that have invested in these Minnesota investor-owned utility companies? Our members rely upon the success of these companies for much of their livelihood. And these are the people that are going to be significantly harmed by this bill because of the financial impact it will have on their investments. These investor-owned companies will be forced to meet these mandates without really knowing the full impact it will have on the company's ability to provide safe and reliable service. The shareholders, because of the financial implications to meet this mandate, and their customers. We MUI members do believe the solar mandates will be expensive to the customer, the company, to our members as shareholders, and in the long term, or not so long term, their customers, the ratepayers of these companies, which again are MUI members. And while we do sincerely appreciate Senator Marty's willingness to remove the 1% surcharge and his study the impacts of increasing the renewable energy standard before imposing even more aggressive renewable mandates, we are strongly opposed to any level of a solar mandate on these companies that our members have invested in for much of their livelihood.
And you have a position on a compromise here, or a way to get to where you could agree on solar, or just an idea for the committee?
Well, I think that there is something in the discussions that we would like to compromise. There is something that is in discussion, my understanding. But I think our bottom line from any perspective, a solar mandate needs to be off the table.
Okay. Go ahead.
I do say, you know, the utilities have been moving forward. They have made a lot of investment in solar energy. So it isn't like, you know, from our perspective, we like to have variety, and we like solar, we like wind, we like coal, we like nuclear. And we do think that these companies that our members have invested in are doing a good job with the resource planning to do a lot of different sources of generation.
Okay. Any questions or comments from the committee? Thank you, Ms. Hinkle. Lauren Lugtug. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lauren Lugtug from Otter Tail Power Company in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. And I'm here today to represent 153 small towns that we serve in western and northwest Minnesota, as well as 1,500 farms. And the emphasis I'd like to make is that we're from small cities in Minnesota. In fact, to take off on Ms. Hodnick's comments, we're probably more like the co-ops. We're more like some co-ops because we have 1,500 farm customers and some co-ops have less. And in some respects, we're more like the munis than the munis because we have smaller towns than some of the munis do. We serve small cities in Minnesota. 90% of all the cities we serve have fewer than 1,000 people. I would ask Senator Marty's indulgence here if I could use my poster child city again. That's Winger, Minnesota. If you stack our 153 cities from from the most populous to the least. Number 77 is right in the middle, and that's Winger, Minnesota. It's up on Highway 59, just south of U.S. Highway 2. Winger has a population of 220 people. The median income in Winger is a little bit more than $21,000. And more than 20% of the residents in Winger are over 65 and living alone. So, in a sense, our company serves the cities where your parents or your grandparents were from. In serving small towns, well, first of all, I should say this. I want to thank Senator Marty for including my company in his bill in Article 8. Our customers need to get low-cost financing for a major refurbishment of Big Stone Plant in just 2.5 miles from the Minnesota border. And Article 8 will facilitate our maintaining our credit rating and getting the lowest cost debt financing available. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm not here today to ask you to do nothing. Solar energy may indeed be the energy source of the future, but what I'd like to ask you is to go slow. No one has argued here today that solar energy is the economic resource and certainly not the least cost energy resource. We could, when we installed wind energy at utility scale, we could argue that wind energy was our least cost energy resource. It's not a load resource, but it's an energy resource. We can't argue that with solar. Even so, the utilities, I think, here are agreeable to doing demonstrations of solar energy, and our support, for example, for the Made in Minnesota provision in Article 4 is an example of that. And our support for what Deputy Commissioner Grant has included in Article 2, we've worked for a long time on some of the provisions there. We probably have a little more work to do, but we've come a long ways in facilitating connections of small generation in Minnesota. My concern here today is with the bill's mandate, as Ms. Hodnick identified, as well as Ms. Hankel. The 2% mandate would cost Otter Tail about $140 million by 2025. And with 153 towns, that comes almost to $1 million a town. Now, keep in mind, we're talking about a lot of towns. Half our towns are smaller than 220 people. These are towns with median incomes in the 20-something thousand range. Not many people who make $20-some thousand are likely to install a $15,000 or $20,000 solar system. Those are more within the reach of folks who make a lot more money than that. It's probably not wise, it's not good energy policy, to force non-economic resources on citizens without thinking about it very carefully. And it's especially unwise, I think, in the case of small cities and small businesses across the state. Some of these folks live right on the edge. Some of them are struggling to survive. Again, median income is in the 20-something to 30-some thousand dollars. And so my company's concern is for our customers in those towns. And for the prices we're talking about for solar, even if they do drop to, say, $2,000 a kilowatt or less, it's a lot of money for people in small towns. And my concern is that the jobs that might come in metro areas, for example, might be at the expense of consumers and jobs in greater Minnesota. So thank you, Mr. Chair. That concludes my comments.
Thank you. Any comments or questions for this witness? Thank you very much. Craig Pagel is the next I am on that. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Pagel. Say your name for the record, please.
Hi, my name is Craig Pagel. I'm the president of the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota. We represent the iron mines of northern Minnesota. We've talked a little bit about jobs. We account for 4,700 direct jobs, and for every mine worker, there's two more workers. The recent study noted $3 billion is added to the gross regional product of the area. By 2016, 3 years from now, that is supposed to double to about $7 billion. That's just iron mining. It doesn't include the copper nickel. It also doesn't include about $4 billion worth of construction. We are, however, right at the cusp of competing on a global market. with the rest of the world right here in Minnesota. Minnesota supplies 80% of the first pour steel in the United States. So I really appreciate Senator Marty looking at how this might affect our industry in Minnesota and the other people in Minnesota, quite frankly. Minnesota Power did run through their rate-making models the original bill. It would have cost the iron mining industry $20 million a year. So removing this section has been very helpful in the long-term economic vitality of the mining industry. I have just seen this language today. I do see one concern that the definition of large power customer or large customer facility would not include the scram mines and also the word using taconite mining operations. These are some very new mining operations that are taking some of the old red ore, not taconite, and recycling, you might say, some of the old ore and making iron product out of that. And we'd hope that the author would consider adding scram mining. The only definition I could find directly, and I'm sure Mr. Knopf would be able to help here, but it was in Rule 6130.0100, subpart 16, actually has a definition of scram mining. That said, we do appreciate the effort. Do have some concerns on the rest of the bill and what those costs might be, since Minnesota Power was not able to estimate what those would be because there's just too many variables. So I would appreciate, you know, moving ahead cautiously on this bill and appreciate the work that's been done. And I stand for any questions.
Any questions, Mr. Pagel? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Rick thank Evans. You. Welcome, Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. Let me start out by saying, you know, as some of the other utility representatives have said, that we do appreciate the tremendous improvements that Senator Dibble has made in the bill, including some of the language that he added.
Marty.
Excuse me. Senator Marty.
Senator Dibble. I'm the invisible hand.
Dibble did do one thing in here, though, so that's good. Yeah.
Yep. Pardon me. Well, we appreciate Senator Dibble as well, but we particularly appreciate Senator Marty and the progress that we've made on this bill. But we still have some concerns, and some of them are serious concerns, and I'd like to just briefly address those today. First of all, before I do that, though, I'd like to create a little context because I think it's important sometimes, you know, particularly as we see all of the interest groups that are around here, of course, of which we are one, certainly. I appreciated the gentleman, I think he left already, who read some of the quotes from our executives talking about our progress in wind, our progress in solar in Colorado. And I think the reason I appreciate that is because I think it brings home to the committee that we are not opposed to renewable energy. We are not opposed to innovative energy. We are not opposed to wind and solar. In fact, we are a national leader in wind and nearly a national leader in solar. The other thing I'd like to say by way of context is if I could walk into my CEO's office today and say, you know what, I know a way we could provide all of the energy our customers need, and there's absolutely no pollution and there's no fuel required, he'd say, you can be the next CEO. We would love to have an energy resource that provided all the needs of our customers, or even a substantial amount of the needs of our customers, that created no pollution and that didn't have a fuel cost. Those are two of the biggest drivers of costs in the utility industry, and if we could do it without them, we certainly would. And I say that just to bring home the point that the concerns that I'm going to address in this bill are not because we are hidebound and love burning coal and think it's great that we pollute and think it's great that we have to spend a lot of money for fuel. It's because we have serious concerns about the effect that this bill would have on our ability to deliver low-cost, reliable energy to our customers. That is our primary, that is our only concern. Having said that, our biggest concern, as the other utilities have mentioned, has to do with the solar standard. We think that solar energy has a lot of promise, but we think that that promise is in the future, and we think that we need to go slow. We think that we need to be careful about how we do this. Under this bill, in the next 12 years, we would have to install about 480 megawatts of solar. That would cost us, even assuming that the price of solar is going to come down, and we believe that it will, that would cost us about $500 million over the next 12 years to provide 480 megawatts of solar energy, of solar capacity, keeping in mind that solar energy has a capacity factor of, depending on the size of it, between 13 and 20 percent, meaning that the 480 megawatts would be produced about 13 to 20% of the time. In contrast to, for example, other equally clean sources, wind is about a third the cost of large solar plants that you might put out on the prairie. And it's about five times, or rather, the solar is about five times the cost of wind if you're talking about the stuff you put on people's roofs. So this is a very expensive resource. Now, the witnesses have testified that we expect the price to come down, and that's, in fact, true. We do expect the price to come down. But I would submit that if I were to tell you, as an expert commodity trader, that the price of gold in 11 years is going to be really low, how much do you want to order for 11 years from now? You might say, come back to me in 11 years and let me see how we're doing, see if your prediction came true. I do think we can predict that the price of solar is going to come down, but this bill puts us on a commitment, a 12-year commitment for a tremendous amount of a very expensive resource on the hope and the expectation that it's going to come down. We would like to see the bill move in a more deliberative fashion, with the opportunity to examine whether, in fact, solar is going to be the panacea that we hope it might be. Another thing, just to give you a perspective on what it would require for us to have 480 megawatts of solar, 480 megawatts of solar would be the equivalent solar panel area of about 2,000 football fields. That's in 11 years. We would put up the equivalent of 2,000 football fields of solar panels. I don't know if that seems like a lot or if it seems like a little, but it seems like a lot of work to do in 11 years with all of the other things that the utility has to do to maintain its system. In addition, this bill gives XL Energy, I don't know what I did to Senator Marty, but XL Energy gets to get to 0.5% in just the next 3 years, next four, counting 2013. 0.5% would be, I think, about 60 megawatts of solar, about 240 football fields of solar panels just in the next 4 years, because we have a 0.5% requirement by 2016 as opposed to zero for the co-ops and munis and a 0.25% for our other investor-owned utilities. In terms of resource planning, that presents a tremendous challenge for us. The other thing that is causing us some concern is we also have large commercial customers, or industrial customers. Those industrial customers compete in an international market for steel, for petroleum products, and they are not given the same privilege as other industrial customers around the state of avoiding the effect of this mandate, and that creates some concern for us as well. We frankly have that same concern for our residential customers, but if industrial customers are the ones that we're going to focus on, I guess I don't know why the industrial customers in our service territory shouldn't be considered just the same. The last thing that I want to mention is, I got a couple more things. The changes in net metering. I do really appreciate the efforts that Senator Marty has gone to fix net metering. I want to add a little bit of an explanation for the committee so they can understand the context of net metering and why this is such a great concern to raise the net metering cap to 1 megawatt, which we do not necessarily oppose as long as you do it right. But here's the concern. When someone puts, a solar panel up on the roof of their building and starts producing their own energy and thereby reduces their energy bill for us, the fact of the matter is they still have a wire connected to their building. They still have a pole to that wire. They still are connected to our entire distribution grid and its substations and transformers. They're still connected to our transmission grid, and they're still connected to our generation. And they're using all of those fixed cost assets every bit as much as they did before. At nighttime, when it's cloudy, when the sun's not shining, they are still using all of those assets. In addition, they're getting an even added benefit for those assets because during times that if they're producing more energy than they're using, they're actually able to feed energy back onto that system and use that system to actually sell energy, really to act as almost a battery for their system to make their solar system more efficient. And yet the only way that we pay for those assets is through the rates that our customers pay. And if a solar customer is able to lower their the amount of kilowatt hours they purchase, then the costs for all those fixed assets that they're still using have to be borne by other customers. Now, the good news from our point of view is that Senator Marty has provided in this bill some terrific strategies for solving that problem. One of them is the buy-all, sell-all program, which would be available for solar. That really solves that problem for our customers so that our non-solar customers are not subsidizing through rates the solar customers. But we have a concern because the increase from 40 kilowatts to 1,000 kilowatts applies not just to solar. It applies to other resources as well. And we believe there's some ambiguity in the bill as to how those customers are going to be treated, and we'd like to continue to see if we can refine that policy as we move forward. The last thing that I'll say is on the community solar piece, and I appreciate Senator Marty has been very willing through the entire process to work on that piece. Community solar is a great idea. The community solar in his bill right now is a very poor design. We do community solar in Colorado. As I think one of the gentlemen said earlier, it's a very popular program. We do know how to do it. This is not the way to do it. And so we want to continue to work on that. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions, Mr. Evans? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one real quickly. Do you have any projections of what this bill will cost the ratepayers in Minnesota overall? Is there any numbers thrown around?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I guess what I can tell you is that actually I really can't because the proportions, I don't know the proportions. We're about half the customers in Minnesota, and we project this bill would cost us about $500 million. But a lot of the other utilities and some of their customers are exempted, so I can't really say that, you know, it would be twice as much as that. It'll be some percentage more than that to cover the other people who are covered by the bill.
Thank you. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Just if I could make a comment, maybe Senator Marty could either answer this or comment on this. According to the U.S. Energy Information Agency, Minnesota has grown 23.9% much faster. I'm talking about electric rates have increased since 2006 as compared to the national average of a little over 11%. Does that seem right? Are those numbers that you know, Senator Marty?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I saw that number on one chart. I remember the filings of the PUC on the impact of the renewable energy standard. I think for all but one of the utilities, I think it showed it either neutral or declining. I know one of them had an increase from that was from the last several years and the impact of the renewable energy standard. And it does have some, I mean, they go up and down differently. But again, as I would point out here, I think the Bloomberg estimate was that 2% standard would be about 1.33% increase, which would be by 2025. Xcel just filed a 10% rate increase request. I mean, the point is these things are changing, and we're talking with big numbers, and we're trying to do a small amount to get the industry jump-started because the prices are going to continue falling. As Mr. Grant said, we think that if we get this started out, that the price will be in the mix with everybody else within the decade, within a decade from now. And I think that's what we want to get going. We want to get the industry just little bits and pieces going. And with that, it'll bring it into the, like what happened with wind. It was expensive 20 years ago, and it's moved down because people learn how to do it better and gets much more efficient to its quantity.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty just mentioned the 10% rate increase that's in front of the PUC that Xcel has filed, but I don't think that's attributable to the renewable energy standard. Mr. Evans, what are the factors that are driving that 10% rate increase?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, you're correct. It is not the renewable energy standard that we believe is driving that. That is in part the fact that our two large nuclear plants and our large coal plant have reached a point in their life when they need upgrades in order to continue to operate and continue to operate efficiently. It is also due to the fact that we are increasing the construction of transmission over the last several years. And to be honest with you, it's driven to a great extent by the fact that either because of the recession or because of the fact that people are using less energy now than they used to, those fixed costs that I was talking about that we have to maintain our system are now being spread out over a smaller number of kilowatt hours, and so that also drives the rate increase. I'm not a rate case expert, and we could certainly bring someone to meet with you if you'd like, but those are among the factors that we're looking at.
Thanks, Senator Dibble. God help us if we do become rate experts. We'll be stuck in these committees for a lot longer. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make I want to ask Mr. Evans one more question, and that's
Please
on the community solar piece. You know, it's frustrating to hear. Well, let me just ask, how would it be designed better? I mean, especially in light of the fact that you're bringing some peaking plants, or you want to either purchase or build some peaking plants in another state, again, exporting dollars out of Minnesota. We're trying to move in the other direction with our overarching energy policy. What models would you think would be useful to Xcel to try to keep some of those dollars more at home?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, The reason to do a community solar program, frankly, is that not every homeowner or every business approaches solar energy the same. If you live among trees, if your house faces the wrong direction, if your house is just not capable of holding up a certain amount of solar panels. And so when you have incentives and special economic subsidies, I guess, to people to put these things up. Not all citizens encounter those the same. If you live in a treeless yard with a house that faces south and, with a good strong roof and a lot of surface area, you're golden. But if you're not one of those people, then you have a problem. And so the use of community solar program, or as we call it in Colorado, a community gardens program, is to construct the solar generation in a location other than on the roof of the people who are participating, and then allow subscribers to participate. The principal problem that we have with the current bill is that it does all of that outside of our regulatory environment. It essentially invites private entrepreneurs to come in and build small solar utilities within our utility service territory in an unregulated fashion and then attract subscribers. We have concerns, as we did when we constructed our solar gardens program in Colorado, that when you're asking people to subscribe to something like this, the Securities and Exchange Commission takes an interest in what you're selling. And so you need to set this up correctly. What we had proposed and still would like to propose is that Xcel Energy be directed to propose a community solar program to the Public Utilities Commission so that they could look at it within their regulatory framework and essentially run it as a regulated business. That doesn't mean we have to own the community gardens. It doesn't mean that we have to be in charge of it. It means that it has to run through the regulatory scheme that I think has served our state quite well. Our problem with the community gardens or community solar piece that is in the bill is that it doesn't really set up a structure that functions within our regulatory scheme, and we would hope that it would.
Any other comments or questions? Mr. Evans. Okay. Thank you very much. All right. Next, I got Joel Johnson. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joel Johnson. I represent the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. Those are the electric co-ops around the state. First off, I'd like to
honestly thank Senator Marty for the way that he's worked with us on this bill. I feel like we've had the opportunity repeatedly to raise our concerns, but not just that, but that we've actually been listened to, and most of our concerns have been addressed. I believe we're real close to a bill right now that not only we can be okay with, but actually support. I think we're making great strides when it comes to the issues that we've had with net metering. I'd also like to thank Director Grant and the DER staff for their stakeholder process to address DG and net metering issues, because I think all of us as utilities realize that solar in particular presents real potential mm-hmm. for our systems, and it can be a real benefit for our members. But we need to do this in a way that is sustainable. And right now, the net metering laws in the state are not sustainable. As Mr. Evans said, when customers completely net out their energy use because we use electric rates to pay for the infrastructure, those customers don't end up paying anything for the infrastructure. And I think we're making great strides with this bill. And I hope, you know, the other thing that I appreciate in this bill is the ongoing conversation we're going to have on this issue and on the issue of renewable energy and on the way that we're going to power our state in the future. I think one of the problems we've had with this bill this year is we haven't talked enough. This is complicated stuff, and it impacts the grid in ways that often seem, that's not intuitive. And we really need to be smart and think this through. And I think there are components in this bill that do that. With that said, you know, we also appreciate being left out of what we think are the bad policies in the bill. And that's really where we're struggling as co-ops. You know, while we appreciate being left out of what we consider the bad policy, that bad policy is still moving forward. In our discussions, we've heard many times how successful the 2007 25 by 25 mandate has been. And every time I hear that, I like to remind people it hasn't been successful for electric co-ops. It's been extremely expensive, particularly over the last few years, where co-ops are losing $70 million a year. And we're, I think, the canary in the coal mine here. And that's why we need to be very careful using mandates to advance these various renewable energy strategies moving forward. But again, I'd like to thank Senator Marty very much. I think we're very close to getting something that co-ops across the state can support, and I think all utilities probably can support. I just would encourage that the conversation continue, whether it's laying over the bill in this committee and having it ongoing here or elsewhere. I do think we're getting closer, and I think the more that we talk, the better the legislation's going to be. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions or comments for Mr. Johnson? Okay. Thank you very much. And is Steve Morris here? I think I saw him walk out. He left. Benjamin Gerber.
How's it take you to get home? 15 minutes. If you don't stop that traffic, I
suppose. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Benjamin Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'd like to start off, like you've heard, Senator Marty has done a great job of listening to specific concerns, as well as his staff, so I'd like to start off by thanking him for that. However, we still have serious concerns from a ratepayer perspective. I think there are still parts of this bill that, and you've heard from some of the utilities about the cost, the cost and the potential cost impacts, and just from our perspective, not enough has been studied to look at this. We heard about there was a joint committee hearing where a person from Bloomberg was brought in to talk about, and I know throughout that discussion he specifically said multiple times that his estimates were not Minnesota specific. What he was talking about was the overall potential cost impacts of solar throughout the various systems. one thing that's important to realize is we've heard New Jersey, through Governor Christie, just signed a solar law that would look potentially similar to what we have here. But New Jersey's rates are on average 50% higher than ours. I think they're over 14 cents a kilowatt hour, according to the most recent EIA data, and we're about 9 cents. So that's a significant difference when you're talking about the potential cost impacts. When their rates are 50% higher, more and more costly resources are going to have less impact. So I think it's important that we take the time to look at this. One of the issues of greatest concern for us has been the over, it's more than 15 rate cases since 2005 from a customer perspective, and commercial industrial customers can't sustain another 10% increase in rates. And we've seen, Mr. Evans had brought up that Xcel would be treated differently than Minnesota Power and Otter Tail Power. And, you know, the commercial industrial customers all compete globally and regionally, and for them to have substantially higher rates, most of them just can't afford it. What we've seen is since 1990, Minnesota commercial rates were 12th in the nation. They're now 18th. Our industrial rates were 15th in 1990. They're now 25th. And overall, including residential rates, we were 9th lowest in the nation in 1990, and now we're 19th. So we've seen a dramatic increase. And on top of that, we have advocates at the table that have brought up that we're going to create a lot of jobs in the solar industry. And while that might be true, it's important to realize that those are going to come at the cost of jobs that we currently have in the system, whether it's at paper mills, whether it's in the mines in Minnesota, and, you know, in small business as well. I mean, for us, there are serious concerns when you exempt one group of customers that have the same types of concerns as another. Industrial customers compete globally and nationally, but there's a lot of small business in Minnesota that does as well. And so to say that one thing isn't good for one group, but it's okay for another, I think we, as the chamber, have serious concerns with that. Within the bill, there's no accountability for the jobs created in the solar industry. We're basically moving into this unprecedented activity where we're treating our utilities that provide reliable and cost-effective electric service into job creation mechanisms, which they've never been done before. And I think there's a lot of concern about that from the chamber's perspective. So I'd just like to finish by saying, I mean, we need to take the time to look and study what these impacts are going to be from a commercial industrial ratepayer perspective. That hasn't been done. We hear the vast difference between 0.33%, I think, which was mentioned potentially by someone from Bloomberg, but we also hear 10 to 15%, and that causes serious concern. And when businesses are looking at whether expanding investment or looking to start a business in Minnesota, they're going to seriously consider what their energy costs are going to be. So with that, I'd like to thank you.
Okay, to be fair, Senator Marty, I think he did exempt mines and paper mills, but at the same time, who knows what the effect might be if prices do go up, and I don't know when they'll go up or where they'll go up, but, you know, I have a provision in here where I want to make solar panels too. So,
Mr. Chair, there's also the suppliers to those industries who may not be large enough to get the exemption. So there's the associated businesses with these industries, the people that supply the paper mills that may not qualify for this, that their prices are going to go up. So we have to consider the downstream impacts of
point
these
well
policies
taken.
As well.
Point well taken. Senator Marty, did you want to say something?
Mr. Chair, when he's done, I just had it.
Oh, okay. I think I have one more after Mr. Gerber. Is there any questions of the chamber? Okay, seeing none, thank you. And I have Wayne Brandt. No, there's one more. Brandt, welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Tomasoni. Wayne Brandt, Executive Vice President, Minnesota Forest Industries. I think I've testified more this session on electricity and energy issues than on forestry and timber issues, which is unusual, but maybe says something about where at least my industry's at. I want to thank Senator Marty for the open way that he has dealt with us and listening to our input. He's been a lot different than what we've seen a number of times in the past on energy issues, where folks deal directly with utilities, but not so much with those of us, whether as an industry or as residential consumers or wherever, that are paying the actual bills. So we appreciate that very much. Ours is an industry, and I won't belabor some of these points. Heard some of them before. The forest products industry has been a leader in renewables for many years. We self-generate about 28% of the electricity that we use from renewable sources. We also utilize additional material for process steam, wood biomass for that instead of other types of energy. Our machines, whether they're in sawmills, OSB plants, or paper mills, don't really care where the electrons come from, whether they come from the sun, whether they come from the wind, whether they come from the water, or they come from the ground. The machines really don't know the difference. But what the business knows and cares about is what the costs are. And the costs are, as I've previously testified, very significant in our industry for energy. We've seen, and I won't belabor Mr. Gerber's points, but we've seen over the past decade in Minnesota a 55% increase in industrial electrical rates. I'm not going to tell you that it's all from the RES, but it doesn't really matter to us whether it's from the RES, whether it's from other factors. It's a cost increase for us in an energy intensive industry. We appreciate Senator Marty putting in the paper mill exemption, recognizing the impact and the potential impact on jobs in our paper mills. We appreciate that very much. Our industry is broader than just paper mills, and I think for those of you that have seen in the media, it's an industry that has been buffeted and battered over the last decade. We've seen four of six engineered wood products facilities that have permanently closed in our state, three OSB plants, one laminated strand lumber plant. We've seen one paper mill that permanently closed, and one hardboard plant that permanently closed amongst my membership. They represent about a third of the wood consumption here in our state, or represented that at the time. I'm not going to tell you that energy was the only factor in those permanent closures, but it was a significant factor for each of them. There is one factor that is common to all of those closures that I mentioned, however, and that is each of those companies is making the same product that they made in those mills somewhere else, either in the United States or in Canada. They're still in the business. They're just making those products elsewhere. So we want to continue to work with Senator Marty before the bill goes forward to continue to improve it, as others have said. And we do appreciate his openness to listening to our ideas and the suggestions that we've made, and hope to continue that dialogue. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members.
Thank you, Mr. Brandt. Is there any questions of Mr. Brandt? Is there anybody else that would like to say something here in the room? Okay. Senator Marty, I'm getting this feeling that some of my friends are for this and some of my friends are against this, and I'm with my friends. Senator Sacktog.
Well, Mr. Chair, is it time for me to make my amendment?
I don't see anything else going on unless Senator Engelbrecht.
Can I just ask one question of Senator
sure,
Marty?
Sure, go ahead.
Senator Marty, there was some talk of the, obviously there's talk in the bill from the mining industry as well as the forest industry being exempted. Was there ever any talk about the silica sand mining in Senator Smith's area? Or how about the bird processing down in Coonan's area? That's a very big industry, as well as American Foods in Long Prairie. Or the Hormel industry in Senator Sparks' area. I mean, we're carving out some, you know, that's the problem I'm having here is those are big industries. Don't get me wrong. I understand that. In fact, I was fortunate enough to tour that with Senator Saxhog, and I don't know if Senator Tomasoni was with or not, but I did get to the mines for the first time in my time, and they are big industries. We're kind of selecting winners and losers here. Was there talk of that is all I'm asking.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, you know, these are not just because they're large industrial users, but they're huge energy-intense users, very intense industry users. And Mr. Brandt could tell you about how many of their paper mills are doing a lot of their cogeneration on-site. With obviously they have wood chips and other stuff that they burn and make part of it, plus hydropower. I wanted to talk about briefly, though, about the talk. I mean, 10-15% rate increases. I think you have in your packets a flyer that was put out that had some of the charts from Bloomberg. And again, these are, when one of the witnesses said these were not Minnesota numbers, these are simply saying if we get to, which is reasonably where we are now for the larger industrial-sized solar things, if it's 15 cents a kilowatt hour, just figuring out it, if you have a solar standard of 0.5%, it would be a 0.33% increase. So you multiply that times 4, you're talking 1 1/3% increase. That's significant. I'm not trying to say that, but by 2025, at the current, at the 0.15, the 15 cent a kilowatt hour, at that rate, that would be 1.33% increase by 2025. Again, as we said, by doing this, the solar cost is going to fall. 1 1/3% is not 10 or 15%. I mean, I understand there people are going to have differences on how they calculate it, but the point is we're trying to get this industry jump started, not only because it's jobs, but because it will be, it's clean. We don't have the environmental problems. We don't have all the other issues related to it, and it's Minnesota. It's Minnesota investments instead of out of Minnesota investments, and I think that is huge. But I just wanted to say, I'm not trying to minimize 1.33%, but I'm saying it's not in the same ballpark as 10 to 15%.
Okay. All right, Senator Saxhog, what do you want to do something here?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would like to do an amendment to page 10. Line 10, which is when we're involved there and trying to describe taconite mining and paper mill customers. And I'd like to propose deleting taconite mining operations and inserting mineral extraction and processing operation facilities and wood products processing facilities that meet the definition of large customer facilities.
Okay, so you would delete taconite mining operations for paper mill customers and insert, or you leave paper mill customers?
No, that's
there.
Good. So, and so Mr. Delete. Fuller can.
Okay, Mr. Fuller, do you have the.
He crafted
okay,
it.
Okay, say it again. Where does
all
it go?
Right. Mineral extraction and
okay,
process.
Okay, wait, you're going to delete taconite mining, right?
Right.
Okay.
Operations.
Taconite mining operations. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Insert mineral extraction and processing operation facilities.
Senator Marty, you okay with that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I assume this would cover the scram mining issue that...
Correct. And wood products processing facilities.
And wood product processing facilities before and paper mill customers?
Yeah, you take off paper mill customers.
So the deletion would be delete taconite mining operations and paper mill customers and insert mineral extraction operation facilities and...
Mineral extraction and processing operation facilities.
Mr. Fuller? Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Fuller, it pointed out that the definition of large customer facility should actually be paragraph paragraph 2 instead of paragraph 1. On line 12, I think. The citation should be paragraph 2.
Let's see.
Right.
Okay, so
And Mr. Chair, speaking again to this, is that as Mr. Fuller looked into the statutes, this better falls in with the law.
Go ahead, Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Saxon, that's correct. I think it is an I, and that's a reference to the SIP law, and this tracks the similar language in SIP law that refers to facilities and mining, extraction, and processing. So it tracks a current exemption law from SIP for large facilities, and this is another exemption from the solar standard. Seems appropriate to track it. There's experience with this language.
Mr. Pagel.
Yeah, Craig Pagel with the Iron Mining Association, Chair. I appreciate the amendment, but with the language that was just spoken, Section 216B.241, Subdivision 1, I'm not quite sure about the paragraph I or II. I thought what I saw was I, but more importantly, this requires it to be 20 megawatts. And the scrap mining would not be part of that group. They're sitting at about 10 megawatts right now. So Mr. while Fuller, we're trying to track a SIP law, it's not bringing in quite the same people that we might have been thinking of.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Fuller.
If that's the case, if they don't meet that threshold and you want to exempt them, we'll have to develop different language. And we'll need the definition of scram mining. I don't know if there's other amendments. Maybe we should see. I know there's one technical amendment from Senator Dibble.
Okay.
Do you want to take the time right now, Mr. Chairman?
Well, Senator Marty, what if...
Mr. Chair, I don't have any problem with Senator Saxog's amendment. I don't know what size the scram stuff is, and so maybe he can talk with Mr. Fuller on that. I would suggest taking Senator Saxog's one that seems to be reasonable. If you could read that again, though.
Well, I think you're trying to get at scram mining, too, though, aren't you?
Well, I am. I am all types of extraction, the power is used. In the wood products industry, of course, we aren't talking just about paper mills. We're talking about sawmills, too. So.
Also, yeah. Hang on. Is Senator Ingebrigtsen to this point?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's what I'm looking for, some clarity here. Are we talking about basically anything else other than what was there to start with? Are we talking about any industries that south of Highway 2 that would be included in this? Does it include the silica sand mining? I mean, if it does, I need to understand that.
You're starting to think like a ranger, see, because we're always worried about north of Highway 2.
That's very obvious here.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the comments I want to make point to some of the same things that I said in Environment and Energy Committee. It's been referenced about the 2007 legislation that was passed and about the great amount of study and work that went into developing that renewable energy law. And the difference here is the fact that that study, that discussion with all the players at the table went into it before the mandates were established. Now we're establishing mandates and say, now we'll sit down and talk about it. There are issues out there. There are issues of excess energy. I mean, there's excess production. When we're mandating a new source of power, it isn't that we're absorbing new energy needs. It's that we're displacing existing energy needs and the generation costs, which we still have to pay for, which our ratepayers have to pay for. We're talking about putting new power into the grid. We're talking about a whole variety of issues that, quite frankly, have not been discussed, have not really been fully evaluated as to what the costs are going to be. And I believe that there is a serious problem with going forward with this type of thing. And it's evident because, okay, we're accepting this group here now, we're accepting that group. And when you have to start accepting all these groups, I think it just points to the fact that this is not the time, this is not where we need to be right now at this point in time. I appreciate the fact, I have a lot of co-op and municipal members, I appreciate the fact that they've been accepted, but I also have Otter Tail Power members in my district, I have XL Energy customers in my district. What makes them any less worthy of being accepted? What makes them any more liable to have to pay that additional cost than the other people that have been accepted? There is an essential unfairness as we look at this entire bill, as we look at how it's being shaped and how it's being developed. And I think here, having this discussion, are we north of Highway 2, south of Highway 2? I mean, it just points to the fact that on an overall basis, there's a lot of problems here.
Senator Dibble?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to point out that 2011 didn't simply just happen. I think it was a little earlier than that. Didn't just simply happen out of, you know, in the aftermath of studies. I mean, this goes, you know, we have the Renewable Energy Objective and the Renewable Development Fund, and we're, you know, actually had stuff being brought online and incentives and ramp-ups, and, you know, we're able to demonstrate that this was a path that we could start moving down. It wasn't just simply a function of, you know, studies and PUC dockets and examinations and that sort of thing. And then we said, oh, let's do a renewable energy standard. The renewable energy standard that we were able to pass was after we'd already taken quite a few initial steps as a state and started putting resources, started incenting production, and started showing that a market could shape up and we could start integrating resources of different types into our overall energy generation mix. I just, you know, that's been said before a number of times, previous committee and this committee, and that's just simply not the case. We're undertaking quite a bit of activity with policy, with dollars, and research and study start moving us down the path. So it's not like Senator Marty's bill is coming out of left field, creating something new out of, you know, whole cloth.
Senator Marty.
And Mr. Chair, one other point, Senator Weber, is the renewable energy standards, the lowest that started at was for non-XL ones was 12%. We're going up to 25%, and we're talking going up to 2% in a similar type of time frame. We're talking about getting baby industry getting started now at a time because we see what's happening with the prices. We know how it's going to happen. We'd like to get a jump start on the industry. We're not talking 12% or 25%. We're talking 0.25% and up to 2% in 13 years, 12 years.
Senator Weber.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, I understand that, but we're also talking about, while we're talking about smaller percentages, we're also talking about much higher cost power. And so the effect is still substantial on our ratepayers. And I think that that's a major problem, and I think it's evident by the fact that we're accepting one group and not another, and there's just a basic unfairness in this.
Well, Senator Marty, what if we laid this over and came back tomorrow or the next day and just gave some people some time here that said that they've got some issues with it, and we voted on it on that either tomorrow or the next day. I heard a lot of people saying that there's a real lot of potential here, and I'd like to see something pass on it, solar this year also. And maybe what we can do is work something out in the next day or two to get this to a peace in the valley position where you're happy, they're happy, and where all our friends are happy, and actually pass something that people can live with, that we won't have to fight with for the next rest of the legislative session. Does that work,
Mr.
for you?
Chair, that's fine. I think we laying it over for a day or two would be a good idea. And I don't know if you wanted to finish Senator Saxog's amendment first, or for that matter, putting this whole amendment on, because I think the objections, as you heard, most of the testimony was based on moving this way because they have a lot more objections without the amendment. But
all right, if the committee will indulge me, let's put Senator Dibble's amendment on the bill so that it becomes the bill, and we'll amend it with Senator Saxhog's language. So do you have Senator Saxhog's language figured out yet, Mr. Fuller? So let's do that. Let's pretend this is an author's amendment and give Senator Marty the courtesy of passing the amendment and making it become the bill. we'll lay it over for consideration and in the future. And in the meantime, people can work on some compromises that they think will work here, and we'll see if we can get this thing done so everybody's happy with it. So, Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. What I would hope is that folks really think Lee has been phenomenally good to work with, but it sounds like people just want to go in and, you know, he listened to us, he gave us 90% of what we wanted, now we want the other 10%, and sort of not, I mean, I'm not feeling a real sense of compromise, real feeling just to move a little bit and stretch their potential. It's like, you know, Senator Marty has unilaterally disarmed, given almost everything, now we're going to go back and get the rest and water down a bill that doesn't actually do anything. That's what it feels like, is shaking up here.
Well, Senator Dibble, I don't know if that's going to shape up to be or not. Maybe we'll come back with the same bill in 2 days, but maybe it won't. I don't know, so we'll see what happens here. In the meantime, Mr. Fuller can figure out the language for Senator Saxhagen. So if we could just move the A33 amendment and make it become Senate File 901 and do that without any problem, then Senator Dibble moves the A33 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion adopted. Okay. Then, Senator Marty, what we'll do is we'll lay this over. I don't know if it will be tomorrow or Wednesday that we can come back here. And if not, we'll figure out a time when we can. And Senator Dibble, do you want to?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think my other bill, I think I got for Mr. Fuller, I didn't get my effective date quite right. I wonder if we need to reconsider my other bill for the purpose of.
You want it? We got it right in the other bill, right?
No.
Oh,
something different.
You know what it is?
Fix it in 10-11.
Okay, we'll fix this on the next meeting too. Then, how's that sound? So make sure you got it right. So it's fixed in the other bill, but it's not in this one. Okay, Senator Ingebrigts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Marty. Thank you very much for this extra time here. I really appreciate an awful lot of work you've done on this. My question to you, Mr. Chair, would be: has this been through Commerce, or what? Does it have to be? Does it have to go to Commerce policy? I don't know.
Senator Marty, this is his omnibus. This is Senator Marty's omnibus energy bill, and it came out of his committee. So, I don't think it has to go to Commerce, right? No. Okay. So, all right. So, with that, members, Senate File 901 as amended is laid over, and we will adjourn the meeting. Thank you all very much for all your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.